And we are live. This is Dark Journalist. What a fantastic crowd we have out there in the ideas room already. And of course, tonight I am joined by the lovely Olivia.
Hi, everybody.
And Olivia, it was cold and it rained and I felt like an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the week started for people with, of course, the brave Robert De Niro coming out to the New York courthouse. But he missed the big lynching, the high-tech lynching that went on in Manhattan against President Trump by about 24 hours. So someone gave him the wrong 411 on that. But it was a humiliating moment for that Hollywood establishment there. And I think some of this nonsense of, you know, sending out Biden surrogates from Hollywood is one of the worst campaign strategies I've ever seen in a lifetime. There's no getting around the political earthquake of them putting Trump in the situation of becoming the first president who is a convicted felon on a totally phony charge with a phony DA, and the entire thing just cooked up in order to swing an election in 2024 and hopefully take their key opponent and place him in jail. This is such a complete abrogation of the Constitution and what the American Republic stands for, that unless it's corrected and reversed, and there's a number of remedies for it to legally be reversed, and a number of legal scholars are predicting it will be because it's so dumb, that we might be seeing that it will take place. But if it's not, for any reason, the whole sort of country, they've created a constitutional crisis with this very unusual case by Bragg and Judge Merchan, whose daughter is taking in all this money fundraising against Trump. You know, I mean, New York, like, I've lived there, okay, it has a lot of things to recommend it. But New York is a shady town. It's always been a shady town. And the kind of forces that operate there in the judiciary have just made it into a total farce. But that farce is electing, is creating an election issue in 2024 in Washington, D.C. And this is where the danger lies and where the constitutional crisis lies. So I'm going to get into that tonight. We have a very special subject we're focusing on tonight, which is Franz Anton Mesmer. And this is very important because there's a great deal about hypnosis and brainwashing and magnetic fluid and the aura and universal interaction of energy. So there's an incredible vast history of what Mesmer brought forth and how it was sort of diminished over the years and came out later with just the simple title of hypnosis, a much, much deeper science. And we're going to get into all of it tonight, including his very interesting relationship with Mozart.
Mm-hmm.
And the secret magnetism trance mystery revealed. This is X Series 171. And it's a fantastic subject for us to get into. I'm going to show you just how deep that somnambulistic trance hypnosis piece goes into the entire line of the mystery schools and all the public developments of these groups like Theosophy and all the fantastic things that came out of the Casey work, Emma Britton, and all the rest, all comes out of this somnambulistic trance state. And all of this harkens us back to the work of Mesmer, who, one of the fabulous things I think about what Mesmer was doing was he was directing it towards healing, which is very much what Casey did with his medical readings. And this is an important thing not to leave out, because very often when we get into the mystery subjects, a lot of people, you know, this whole thing about attunement. And I think this is where a lot of the Crowleyite people end up getting lost, because there's so much focus on, you know, that kind of attunement and self-aggrandizement that it becomes. There's a line in the Casey work about attunement and service and how you have to kind of match them up, or it becomes this kind of like, nuclear explosion of Kundalini energy, as it were. But we're going to get into this tonight. And it's interesting because everyone from Mozart to Charles Dickens to Emma Britton to Marie Antoinette
mm-hmm.
shows up tonight. So this is a power-packed episode for you. What we're going to do is I'm going to present everything that's going on in the political piece around here and the big threat to the American Constitution and our, you know, way of life in America that this case represents in this, you know, the 34 charges against the former president to try to keep him out of the Oval Office. And we're going to start with that, and then we're going to do a so about 45 minutes of that, about 45 minutes of the Mesmer presentation, then 45 minutes of your questions, Miss Olivia.
Sounds great.
How does that sound? Before I go any further, Miss Olivia, how's the temperature out there?
Temperature's pretty good, excellent, all things considered. So this is a great comment. Tim Houston said, I saw a nightclub hypnosis act. It was wild. Guy from our table volunteered. It was eye-opening. Really scary potential. Can't do anything against your will? Very easy to subvert will. No wonder hypnosis doesn't get a lot of media play. We're hypnotized nearly every time we pay attention to a screen.
Well, that's true. You can use suggestion in a number of different ways. And there's nothing inherently sinister about suggestion. I mean, you can tell somebody, you know, you can give them confidence. Of course, there's a number of people who have personality coaches and all kinds of things. And that's all about building up the person's ego structure. There's the whole suggestion of discipline that goes on in the military. There's a series of suggestion. What we don't understand, and why there's a rather large mystery riding right underneath the surface of what we know, because we understand things about hypnosis. We understand things about suggestion. However, the larger picture is that underneath there in the subconscious connecting up to the superconscious is a structure that can be opened up and explored. And so these are talents that we have latent within us, and they become manifested when we show the interest and tap into them, just like any kind of practice, whether it's meditation or psychic influence. So a lot of people have attributed things to hypnosis at times. The real truth is that hypnosis is an incredibly vital tool. The thing is, our understanding around it is missing dramatically. And what Mesmer opened up and what Paisiguer, who was a great student of his, really got into, and with this really incredibly edgy research beyond it, tapping directly into that superconscious, and I'm going to get into those cases tonight, is a piece that was completely bypassed by psychology. So you got this very flimsy version in psychology and psychoanalysis, so that psychoanalysis and psychology, which I studied in college, I found tremendously wanting because it was very limited and it kept things in a nice little pen. And so, you get some of the people who go a little bit deeper, but they're few and far between. What I always understood was the form, you know, they needed a form for it and they needed to rule out certain things. So they got rid of the deeper aspects and the kind of supernatural pieces, and they just went for this kind of mainline thing, which turned into the pharmacopoeia and the corruption of the pharmaceutical industry, which we have today. And that, you know, this is how deep this dysfunction goes. Getting into it and getting into tapping that subconscious in the proper way can actually correct the entire problem that we have with psychology in the world today. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. This is X Series episode 171. It's fantastic to be here with you, of course, at the end of May here. And we did a series of shows on Atlantis this month. I thought this was particularly important. We started the month off with our new documentary, which is Hacking Atlantis, The Craze in the Hot Zone, which collects all those ideas that I've been putting together around this advanced culture right there in the Bahamas and all the political intrigues involved. And I've made that available for free on this channel. And then we did some follow-up episodes to give us kind of a greater understanding around the topic. And of course, this is right in the heart of everything that's going on as well, because a lot of the revelations that we see going on, and you know, where the veil is lifting around certain things, unfortunately, there's an effort out there to really, you know, pull things back in a more superficial fashion. So you're getting, kind of a dumbed down thing, in the traditional and in the alternative type media, trying to say, oh, look, it's a new revelation about UAPs. They're not UFOs. They're UAPs. They're a threat and all the rest. And we've been treated to this whole dance in the past couple of weeks about all of these UFO whistleblowers, the CIA version, not the real ones, the CIA guys like Elizondo saying, you know, I've been threatened and all this stuff. And then there's a big loop of, you know, self, they're all kind of validating each other, which is funny. And this gets us into interesting territory because there's a reason they're doing this with the imminent disclosure of a book called Imminent by Elizondo. They need something to pump this up. And so they put Gary Nolan out there, who has worked for the CIA on record. Elizondo is straight out of the CIA. And all these guys are like, oh, you know, we're being threatened because the government doesn't want you to know this. Well, then why are you working for the government? You know, you work for the government and they're threatening you. I mean, this is the circular logic in the UFO field is ridiculous. And as a field, you know, a lot of these guys, Grush, Mellon, the deep state players who are putting this forward, the kind of, you know, that X protect line that we've covered in this show, they're bringing that field into a totally useless in terms of learning place. And what they're doing is they're just coming up with things that they can fly through the media and, you know, get their guys promoted up there so they can promote this UFO threat and then have the UFO Defense Office through Congress, you know, arrow and steroids and all this kind of thing. That is where they're going with it. And they've really had a hard time because they've chosen some of the most marginal players, people who aren't very good at this. But the key players orchestrating it in the background that we can see, Chris Mellon is one of those people. And I'd like to keep him high in our awareness because whenever we get around this UFO thing and the people that are playing these games about these whistleblowers and pretending that they're under threat when in fact they work for the CIA, which is the threat agency after all, we have to be very aware of who's pulling their strings. And what I've found from my own personal experience and laid out in this program is Mellon is one of those. And so it's very important that, you know, that UFO thing be sort of cataloged correctly, which is there's UFO file research. That's the real thing. This other CIA sideshow that we're seeing, which is meant to orchestrate a threat to grant emergency powers to a certain aspect of the government, which has its place with the continuity of government players. That's the thing to cut off when it comes up and to call it out when it shows up on the radar and not let it get any kind of foothold. And they have their own internal squabbles for sure, but they've been pumping this up quite a bit, and they're being promised that they're going to get, you know, congressional hearings this summer when things are slow and they can experiment with different formats. But this is important too, because in this period of time, you're getting into things, you know, I started off with this month, we did all these shows on Atlantis. Look, that whole piece is a major part of what the mystery schools have brought forward. So the whole finding out about Atlantis, that Atlantis Rising piece is important. It's crucial for humanity. And the mystery schools have given us that real thing to follow. Unfortunately, you're going to find, just like there's false UFO disclosure, there's going to be false disclosure around things like the ancient connection and the real genuine history of our planet. So, you know, we have to kind of go very steadily into this wild period. But one of the things that I think is very telling when we get into this is they have a certain line that they're trying to bring out, and it is coming from a very transhumanist place. And that's something that, you know, through the work that we've done in the Rudolf Steiner work and Ahriman and others, these schools and esoteric institutions, even though they've remained underground, they've been public enough to put these things out intentionally. So we have a kind of breadcrumbs to follow, as it were. So when we get into areas tonight, like we're going to with hypnosis and things, you know, on the surface, many of us have just heard about, you know, hypnosis the way that that person was talking about it, you know, like a stage hypnotist. And some people have heard about it, of course, in terms of past life regression or, you know, recovering alien memories of UFO encounters and alien abduction and things like that. So there is some thread of it there over time, including the fact that reincarnation came back into our consciousness largely through the search for Bridie Murphy, which is a book all about a woman who goes into a hypnotic trance to try to recover early childhood memories and goes a little bit further back into her past life in Ireland and discovers the kind of foundations of why she has so many traumas. That whole thing is a real thread in culture, and it's sitting there. It's like a great secret just waiting. And I'm going to get into tonight how mesmer fits in with all that and why mesmer's work through the personage of Deepai Sagir really brought this forward. Before we get into all that, though, I'm going to actually jump into this Trump thing. Sure. What have you got out there?
Well, I just want to say this one comment. Charles Cheatham said, "I stopped smoking in one night after 40 years with hypnosis. It works."
There's no question. Oh, there's no question. I've done a number of, I have a lot of personal experience, understanding from study of hypnosis. And, you know, with things like insomnia, for example, there's very simple things that people have done, which, you know, if you write down the suggestion, "I'm going to be asleep by midnight" or whatever, your unconscious picks it up and boom, you're asleep at midnight. So these are important pieces, I think, very simple things that can be understood. And, you know, there are very powerful examples around suggestion. One of them was given to me by an acupuncturist that I had a little while ago. And this was very interesting. He was telling me a story involving hearing loss and how they were trying a particular homeopathic remedy on a child who had hearing loss. And he told me the most almost supernatural, bizarre thing happened. And we know homeopathy already is a very unusual science and a mystery science because it, you know, it's something where they have the essence of the thing and they water it down so much that the actual chemical composition is gone. And yet something, some energetic thing remains and it triggers the system. And in the case of the hearing loss, saying the name of the remedy itself cured the deafness. Now, what advanced level is that? That's not even a suggestion, is it? It's something that goes even beyond. So we have a number of unusual things when we get into this. Of course, there's a famous example of Edgar Casey, you know, getting into his somnambulist trapped through a hypnotist originally. But during one of these sessions, when the sleeping prophet Edgar Casey was giving these readings, there was a doctor in the room, and he was telling somebody to move their chair up, but it came off as a suggestion or a direction for Casey's body to lift up off the table, which it did. And so 8 people saw Casey's body levitate when the doctor said up, up for the chair. So, you know, there's some special piece that's going on there, which is not something that can be observed in traditional fashion with our regular way of looking at things medically or scientifically. It's a whole different science that is being studied in the background by the very same people who deny it in the public. And that's where the story gets particularly interesting. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. This is Mesmer Mozart and Secret Magnetism, Trance Mystery Revealed. We're going to get into what that trance mystery is in this X series, episode 171. Before we go any further, I want to remind you to actually go to the darkjournalist.com website and sign up for our newsletter. That's a free newsletter, but it keeps us in contact with each other around this incredible, and I've been demonstrating this for people recently the ridiculous censorship that we're under with this program. And it is quite phenomenal. I have to say, this has to be some of the worst that we've seen. And there's a reason for that beyond election season. But these are the types of ideas they like to suppress. But signing up for the newsletter gets us around that. It shows up once a week. That's a free newsletter for you right in your inbox to let you know about the incredible X-Series shows we have coming up for you. Documentaries, events, interviews, things you won't believe this summer. And you got to stand up and be counted. Make sure that you're on that newsletter list. And it takes only a minute to subscribe. So go ahead and do that. And while you're there, if you want to get behind the program and subscribe to what we do, we've made that very easy and affordable for you. Okay. The disaster in Manhattan. Oh, boy.
Is it a disaster? A lot of people are saying that now they've completely exposed themselves.
True.
There can be no doubt.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, the Nazis storming Poland was, you know, it exposed the Nazis, but it was a disaster nonetheless. Mm-hmm. This is a disaster for a lot of reasons. So we have a situation in this country where we have somebody who's up there operating as a figurehead who mentally is not capable of the job because he has dementia and other issues, and he's being controlled. That's one big, big problem. Two, whoever the group is that's dragging us into this, the deep state behind the Biden regime, is pulling us into a World War III scenario. And we have a very small window before that gets accomplished through their efforts at, for example, they just gave the Ukrainians the ability to fire American missiles into Russia. That's a first. Before, they said you can't do that. Now, hey, go for it. Doesn't matter because old Joe is in charge. But old Joe was about to be booted out because inflation is terrible. The economy is terrible. And, you know, he and his policies are a complete disaster. And if I were to list them, I could keep you here all night just listing the Biden regime and the crimes that they've committed against the American public. But even, you know, even beyond that, just the incredible, you know, destruction of America as a country by shredding its borders, by saddling its citizens with all this debt, and then by taxing everybody to such a degree that, you know, you don't, and then to depolice certain cities and all the rest of it. We're having this issue here in Boston. Now Mayor Wu has come forward and said, we don't want to prosecute for shoplifting anymore. And if Wu pushes this to the point, I'll lead protests on a daily basis against Mayor Wu. Mark my words, there's no question about it. Because although that stuff can play in San Francisco and the rest of it, Boston is different. And there's a core here that will fight back against that. And you will see real pushback. There's no question about it. But the fact that they're trying it and that they installed Wu as this kind of, you know, socialist Soros puppet here to try to accomplish the things and make Boston, you know, a terrible city that they've made San Francisco into. And, you know, I lived in San Francisco for many years. There's so much to recommend it, but the way that they've driven it down, I've seen it, you know, the decadence there.
That is a disaster.
And it could be brought back. There's no question. This is the wonderful thing about all these things that we're talking about. But they are trying this, and the Biden administration, this is part of this program, and they slowly moved this in. You know, they did it during the Biden administration. They've done it during the Obama administration. All the seeds of it were being put in, and then COVID gave them this weird excuse to go haywire. What's interesting is they don't have any cards to play in a normal election scenario. Right now, President Biden, Stepford Biden, is at 32% in the polls. No one can govern, let alone win an election, with those types of numbers. And with the incredible influencing, you know, when they had all these kind of dialogues back and forth between Bragg and the Biden White House, between Fannie Willis and the Biden White House, this is a disgrace. And the judiciary, the legal system, the DOJ, the whole thing needs to be cleaned up because it's making America into a banana republic. They will just prosecute their enemies. When they went after Trump in Mar-a-Lago, it was such a departure from normal activity that we knew something was up. And of course, I attributed parts of that to the UFO file as well, because, you know, and I see this bastardized a lot. About Trump and his background with his uncle. We've brought forward a lot of things about John Trump on this program, and they've been bastardized. But nonetheless, they're out there, which is a good thing. And the only reason I say they're bastardized is they always bring up the fact of the Tesla link with John Trump, but they leave out the UFO file piece. That's the crucial aspect, the person who sends Uncle John in. And of course, Trump talked about Uncle John just a few days ago. That whole thing, this whole piece, is crucial. You have to connect up Vannevar Bush when you're discussing the Tesla aspect with John Trump, and then extrapolate that out to the kind of Roy Cohn knowledge base, to the, you know, John Trump knowledge base, to the Nixon knowledge base. Trump has all of that. So we've shown those threads, and we've completed connecting those dots and put them out there. And what you see over and over again is is this just this kind of like slight thing towards Tesla and Trump. You have to get the full story, which is the UFO file is sitting right, hanging there right in the middle of it. But what does that mean? What it really means is part of the get Trump thing relates directly to the knowledge that he has about these things, which puts him on the same level as certain players in the deep state. That's a real, real problem. And you can go all over the board as far as political personalities go and who would be the best president and all the rest. Look, if you don't get Trump elected in November and you have Biden reelected, then the whole country will go away and it won't be quiet. But, you know, all the rights in the country are already being sliced and diced. You cannot have a situation, an unconstitutional situation like what we saw take place in that Manhattan courtroom, which was a complete, and I mean a complete, miscarriage of justice. It was by every, you know, take the legal standard of people like Jonathan Turley, who isn't a Republican by a long shot. They know the whole thing was a disgrace, that they took some paper entry and extrapolated this whole thing out into a felony, which this guy just made up, Alvin Bragg. And everyone who was defending the case, and even the defendant himself, didn't actually know what they were being charged for, and neither did the jury. They kept asking the judge for the instructions of what's the crime exactly. And he said, you can pick anything of these crimes, and if some of you like this crime, and some of you like that crime, and some of you like this crime, then you can put that all together and say it's a unanimous decision. I mean, this is a kangaroo court. And it's some of the sleaziest tactics. And all those people should go to prison, including Mershon and Bragg and all the rest of it. You know, that is a criminal conspiracy to remove an official that's winning an election. You cannot, there is no precedent. And the way that they just talk about it in the media, talking about it like, well, Trump's in this case or whatever. Look, you cannot take a presidential candidate who's winning and prosecute him with the DOJ of the other team. You can't do it. And that's what they've been doing. And as a matter of fact, if they didn't get it in New York and this thing will be reversed, you know, they would try to get it in Georgia. Well, that woman fell on her face because it showed how compromised those people were. So they're using very low level people to get this accomplished, but they'll do it with Jack Smith also. And they'll do it with the documents case as well. It can't be allowed. And the only way to really end it is to end the Biden regime. The Biden regime has to be removed through the election on November 5th. There's no question about it. The forces that are in this election, and you know, I've done a great deal to put a spotlight on Bobby Kennedy, RFK Jr.'s work. And what happened with his candidacy is that he started off running for the Democratic election. And they moved the rules basically around so he couldn't get anywhere. And then, and as a kind of Hail Mary 11th hour thing, he threw down last fall to say, I'm going to run independent. But there was no infrastructure available. So he was able to bring up some good issues and get some good fundraising going. But there's no, and I mean, I've studied elections for over two decades. there's no path to victory for RFK Jr. in this election. It doesn't exist. You need 270 electoral votes. There's no path to 270. There's no path for electoral votes for Kennedy's campaign. That's just the fact of it. Now, he set himself up by having the good issues to really, you know, wait for 28. And that's what the Bobby Kennedy, you know, that whole thing with RFK Jr., that's what he should be doing, which is setting it up for 2028 and saying, I'll take 4 years and build this independent movement and then we'll have it. But I can tell you for a fact, they can't get any electoral votes because all the states that they're looking at, you know, these states are locked in. They're either Republican or Democrat. And then you have toss-up states and that's it. You know, it's not like somebody can roll in and say, I just want to run for president and get to 270 electoral votes. It doesn't work. Whoever is telling him that in that campaign needs to be real straight honest because he's putting out a lot of these things. And they're like, look, we got on the ballot in so many states. Now we almost have 270 electoral votes. Well, no, you know, that's not 270 electoral votes. That's being on the ballot in states that have electoral votes that other candidates are going to get. I don't know what the disconnect is there, or if they're just saying that, you know, they keep going back to the polls that say, look, we're doing well with young people. Look, young people are a very small part of the electorate. You know, they're tiny. In fact, and you can't win with young people. You know, if you could do that, then you'd have a lot more, you know, the elections would be a lot different, but the demographics are totally different. And I like, you know, what RFK Jr. has talked about in the campaign, but he has not gone after the head dog here. He has not gone after Biden. And that is the crucial thing. You have to take on President Biden. Now, at this point, with the disaster and the unconstitutional action, the Biden administration and his weird giggle today when they were saying, is Trump a political prisoner? And, you know, Biden's like, hey, you know. I mean, it's becoming a sick Frankenstein show. What we need to do is the Bobby Kennedy campaign, this is my advice to them. This is my free advice for the Bobby mm-hmm. Kennedy campaign. And, you know, I've had him on the program and I've talked with him. I do find that he has great ideas. It's just this isn't the election to do it. What he needs to do is say, this is such an affront to my legalistic mind, because he's been a lawyer his whole life, and say, you know, I cannot, you know, tolerate this. What I'm going to do to make sure that this corrupt regime does not remain in power is I'm going to throw my support to President Trump in this election, and I'm going to come back with a full-blown independent run in 2028. And if he does that, he'll probably get the support.
He can't do that. He's married Trump. To a Hollywood star.
I'm saying, you know, this is the real thing, because the stakes are too high. And everything you're saying is mm-hmm. true. However, none of that matters anymore, because if they can do it to Trump, they can do it to Bobby. They can do it to anybody. And, you know, when they were working with the Kennedy thing, when the deep state was working on how to neutralize that, the modus operandi was assassination. And what they do now is a kind of legal assassination. So if they can wrap you up in court and then throw you in jail, this is what they're after and what they're all about. They've demonstrated it, but this is the most corrupt version. They've never demonstrated in another administration anything like this. So this is, I want to tell you, as somebody who's looked at politics for decades, this is not normal. And we're in a different dynamic because of what they did with their 34 counts of this, you know, 167 years of prison for President Trump, who's winning the election. This is Banana Republic. It's a constitutional crisis, and it'll manifest more and more as a headline like that. Right now, you know, the legal experts were saying, even as they were going into this, they were like, this judge is like Alice in Wonderland. This prosecutor's like Alice in Wonderland. What on earth is going on? And then his instructions to the jury, pick your crime, and then that's unanimous. I mean, this is all corrupt stuff that's going to be reversed. But they're moving into this is a Soviet-style system. This is like what the Germans did with their kangaroo Nazi courts to get rid of their enemies. I mean, it's not America. You can't have America be like that. And the only way you can do it is through these little tiny moves through these state corrupt prosecutors and then mash them together with this federal system. It's a disgusting thing that Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, is overseeing this process. What they need to do is get the Supreme Court involved, and the Supreme Court needs to say, you, Alvin Bragg, Judge Merchan, this whole thing. And by the way, Merchan is going now, his next case is who? Steve Bannon, who is, Trump's big promoter, campaign promoter guy. I mean, what are you going to do? Go down the line and have Merchan just create all these phony charges against these people? Ultimately, this is a constitutional crisis, and it's coming in from a different way, because usually you'd say, well, constitutional crisis, they're rolling tanks or something is going on. Well, what they're doing is they're using the legal system to prosecute their enemies, their political enemies. That's fascism. So, you can't tolerate it. You can't move forward like everything is normal. What you can do, and the ability that you have, is to remove the Biden regime. But you can't have splinters out there and people. This is why the Kennedy thing is important, and why my suggestion is that he throw his support to Trump right now, is that would make that's a historic move. And this is important too. It's important for Bobby to remember that Jack Kennedy, when he was running, he ran for to be vice president for Adlai Stevenson in 56 and didn't get it, and then became the crown prince in 1960 and really went in and became an incredible president. So it's not like you have to win the first time that you throw your hat in. So they've thrown their hat in. They thought they were running as Democrats. The Democrat system was so corrupt, it kicked them out. Then they ran as independents. But what it appears to be doing, and I think that Bobby has admitted this himself now, he said that 57% of his voters would, normally be Trump voters. So, he's not getting a big, it's just in certain states that he's getting any traction. So I'm not saying that, there's a big, there are large numbers there. I think what's important, though, this is crucial, which is anything that's going to move that electoral focus in different states and winning the election with all the kind of shenanigans that we saw in 2020, everything's going to be important. And so therefore, Bobby needs to throw his support to Trump. And I'll tell you why that's important, because otherwise you could wind up with a little finagling situation in the background where the whole thing where nobody gets to 270 and then it goes to the House of Representatives. You get one or two never Trumpers and the rest of the Democrats, and they somehow drag the corpse of Joe Biden across the finish line and then install Kamala Harris or Gavin Newsom. This is where they're going, and it's a sick situation. So it can be stopped at the ballot box in November. That's where the plan needs to go. All the conversations are going all over the place. Look, all the conversations can get centered very clearly. This push needs to be get rid of the Biden regime. The only person who can do it is Trump. So that's where this is going. It's absolutely important. I cannot emphasize it enough that America cannot sustain itself as a constitutional republic under the Biden regime if they were to win again in November. So that has to be kept in mind, borne in mind as we go forward. And we have the means at our disposal at the ballot box for this election in November. And the numbers are terrible for Biden because, the numbers are so low for Biden that even with fraud, they're not going to be able to remain in power. But there needs to be unity on the opposition side. You can't have this guy splitting off over here and saying, I've got 10% of the vote, and this guy, fighting against the main challenges. Everybody has to get together against the Biden regime and crush the Biden regime. And then Bobby can come back in 28 and really make some noise. That's the way. Those are the real kind of political conversations that should be going on. This other thing, that's going on, and the kind of, take the libertarian thing. Look, there was some fantastic political theater that went on in the past couple of weeks. One, Trump in the Bronx. Okay. Trump goes into enemy territory, basically, and gives this incredible speech there. And he talks to those people and says, look, Biden's destroying your economy, and he's opening your borders, and he's flatlining America. he's right. And people in Democratic Bronx, you know, swarmed to see him say this. And, you know, they took it very positively. Then Trump goes into what was almost hostile territory at the Libertarian Convention. He delivers that message. And this is interesting because all the shenanigans that were tried against Trump at the Libertarian thing, you know, to try to get people to boo him and all the rest of it. And he wound up kind of winning the day there. And the Bobby dance with the Libertarians doesn't feel honest enough. And Bobby and his, you know, his campaign is a little bit different from the candidate. And I feel like Bobby is an honest person. And so him dancing to Libertarian stuff doesn't really, he's not a Libertarian. And the campaign is trying to paint him as all things to all people. So they were trying to use that as a wedge against Trump. And it basically came off as like Trump versus Kennedy, while you have this incredible corrupt machine of Biden escaping in the background with his 32% approval. You can't have that situation. You have got to unite all the opposition against the Biden regime. And I've said it here, I'll put it on record. November 5th could be, you know, Trump could probably win 60 to 65% of the vote if everybody just unites behind that message and you get the country back. At least you start there. And then in 2028, you can have an all out thing because neither Biden nor Trump is available to run, you know, for 2028. Both these guys are done. And this is important. I think that there's a lot of purist snobbery around any candidates right now. You're not going to get, you know, a hero on a white horse with this one. What you can get is anyone who understands the Constitution and can implement the constitutional principles. That's the guy that we need. And you
have on a flipping border. I'll take that.
Exactly. So just to round this thought out, there's no way around it. I hear a lot of things in the independent space about, oh, you know, we're too good for that presidential race, you know, and the presidential thing doesn't matter. And, you know, focus on your local elections and all that. Fine. Look, you can't ignore the presidential election. These people are running the Department of Justice. You have to get with the deep state and go in there and root them out of the FBI, the CIA, and the DOJ. You have to have the ability to do that. And right now they're ruling the roost and they will continue to take territory unless they're stopped. The best way to stop them is at the ballot box. It can be done. They're in tremendously terrible shape. Any election person who's looking at this election here, you know, going into the summer of 2024 will tell you there's no way that Biden could get reelected. No way. The only way it could happen is if the opposition splits. You know, the if they split the throw the bums out vote, then that gets very tricky and it becomes harder. So all the attention should be on that. And no, like, you know, the energy around these other campaigns going after Trump or whatever, forget it. You know, your enemy is the Biden regime. That's the thing that needs to be replaced. There can be no substitute, you know. Biden, that whole Biden regime and the policies that they've been implementing, you know, this goes back to a whole wave that they are really the titular head of, if you think about it. And this includes the whole trans thing with chopping off kids' body parts and, you know, all the things that they've been doing to wreck the culture. This all is coming down to this deranged Democrat piece. There's no way around it. And you know, you get also the corrupt Republicans, like the Cheney-style Republicans, and they want American empire and all the rest of it, and they'll do anything to get it. They're married to a future that is something like you wouldn't believe. It's a totalitarian nightmare that we want no part of. So the fastest way, you need the top, you need the presidency. The presidency, it's like a body politic, and then you need the head. And the presidency is the head in this case. And so you can't have all these people saying, well, you know, presidential elections don't matter and, you know, worry about something else. You know, anyone who's telling you that is ill-informed or, you know, they just have their own blocks because the presidential election in 2024 nothing could be more important. And if I could say to you, you know, it's not about endorsing any particular candidate. The truth is only the Trump administration can stop the Biden regime. That's, you know, only the Trump campaign can do that. Trump has been president, and Trump has demonstrated that he does, you know, care about things like borders and the Constitution. And so however somebody would feel about Trump, you know, you cannot, there's no equivalency. You know, this regime is going after its opponents using the Department of Justice. I mean, it's a sick situation, and that we need to get to the other side of it to return balance to the strategic situation in America, which is a constitutional republic. You cannot have, you know, 10 million enemy aliens coming into the country. So I cannot emphasize it enough. The opposition needs to unite, and libertarians, the Kennedy campaign behind the Trump campaign, and the Trump campaign will defeat the Biden regime in November by over 60% in my prediction, if they do that. And this is where the emphasis needs to go, you know, in independent media and in other places. I would never tell you how to vote ordinarily, but the Biden regime needs to be removed. After this is the most egregious act that's taken place in America on the presidential side. You know, we've never seen anything like it. They don't do this. So we're in unknown territory. And the way we can return this back is to return some kind of constitutional leadership back to the people. And then if everyone's going to fight it out for 2028, that's fine. But we can't, in the meantime, go under the waves with the psychotic Biden-Harris regime, which has proven itself to be a fascist outfit. There's no question about it. Everyone, you're watching The Dark Journalist Show. Woo! Well, we are getting into it now. And I told you that was a bridge too far, the Manhattan incident, I think it'll be called. But everyone's going to remember this going forward. And we will get the country back, make no mistake about it. So what we're going to do is I'm going to present the entire Mesmer piece here, and then we're going to take your questions in the second half of the program, which Miss Olivia is putting together now. Before I go any further, Miss Olivia, you're up.
Okay. BKK says, DJ, who would you pick for Trump's VP?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different, the thing is, Trump is such a big personality that whoever you get, you're not going to get somebody on that same charismatic level. And I think that people look for that. What you usually get behind a guy like that is kind of a stiff, you know, like Mike Pence was a stiff. And that's the way it goes. You know, you're kind of the rule behind choosing a vice presidential candidate is do no harm. And so there's a number of people, you know, I think that are floating out there. I would like to see a female presence on the ticket because I think this is a demographic that Trump struggles with. And I think it would be a good sign also for future leadership. And, you know, a lot of people, yeah, Tulsi Gabbard, people bring her up. Look, she's a Democrat. But this is somebody who's been in the military and she would be an excellent pick. She turned down Bobby when he asked her, which I find interesting.
Because she wants to be Trump's VP.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing you could do with somebody like Tulsi is make her Secretary of Defense when you get into a second term. So there's a lot there that could happen. What they have right now is J.D. Vance, who is the senator from October, from Ohio. And he is somebody who's been kind of going around doing these interviews. They have Tim Scott from South Carolina. I find him maybe not such a good possibility because he's been outspoken against Trump in the past. So I don't like that kind of sliding around part. But I think that there's a number of good candidates. I'd start on the female side. Because I do think that's one place, you know, you want to go for the best candidate, but maybe it would be a good idea in this case, for sure. And look, I think there have been some tough characters like Stefanik, who got all this stuff going around the universities and really shook them up, saying, you know, what are these policies you have going on? She's the one who said we need to investigate Bragg and sent a letter to the Manhattan you know, Department of Justice about doing that. I like to see that type of action. So, yeah, I think there are some good opportunities. I would avoid people like Rubio, who is a hawk and is, you know, I don't think actually a Trump fan. So, you know, some of those people that are kind of ingratiating themselves, you know, I'd go outside and around that. I'd go for somebody who has a real hardcore loyalty. And of course, you know, somebody who you think might have a shot in 2028 as well. Yes, what do you got?
Okay, I think we should move on from the politics.
No, go ahead. You're right.
Well, Ray Nabosny says Trump raised $54 million.
Oh, yeah.
Since yesterday.
Well, see, this is the thing. People know when an injustice happens and they vote with their dollars. And you're seeing a lot of voting there. Think about what that represents for people's interests coming forward in November. It's going to be a landslide against the Democrats if, you know, see what they're trying to do. I should explain this as well, which is what Judge Mershon has tried to work out, is that he's going to try to sentence Trump on July 11th, 4 days before the Republican National Convention. You know, you can't do that. That is election interference. Literally, the Supreme Court needs to step in, take this guy's license away and set up, you know, scrap that trial and, you know, say this is election interference. That's what would happen, because what they're doing is they are initiating, you know, those are crimes. If you have people who are colluding in the background for a particular campaign to get this candidate, that's a crime. So, you know, Supreme Court needs to step in and say, no, you can't prosecute the person who's leading in the presidential race on behalf of the other guy. This is what it, you know, this is where we're going with this. So we're absolutely in a situation where this needs to be taken up to a totally different level. And so we're going to get into very interesting territory when you get into July, which is the Republican convention in Milwaukee, and then the Democratic one is in late August in Chicago, which, by the way, the last time they had it in Chicago was in 1968, you know, that incredible Mayor Daley explosion on the college students and all the violence that took place there. And Robert Kennedy was running in that year, you know, RFK Jr.'s dad. So there's a lot of strange echoes and parallels going in here. And I find it very important for us to take a look at this from a different point of view and say, you know what, this is the presidential election that counts. And it's going to be crucial for us going forward. Everyone, you're watching The Dark Journalist Show. This is Mesmer, Mozart, Secret Magnetism, Trance Mystery, revealed with an incredible kind of world politics update right up front there. And this is the nature of where things are going. We're going to take your questions in the second part of the program. And so I'm going to jump into that here, but what else do you want to give me?
Let's jump into that immediately.
Yeah, you know, I think where I kind of picked up and left off with all this is interesting, because we had started with this idea around hypnosis. And there's a whole notion of the hypnosis of life, as it were, and the kind of brainwashing that takes place in propaganda. And the truth is, this is exactly what we've been seeing a lot of. And we've been under a lot of that oppression of the, you know, this comes down to the World Economic Forum and others, this push for a totally different type of society. And that goes to the CBDC, you know, the central bank digital currency, the AI piece, you won't own anything by 2030. This whole aspect is a gigantic hypnotic hypnosis of life brainwashing technique that's been taking place there. And what you need to do is wake up from the trance. Well, that's what the general public needs to do. And you can see this happening. Slowly but surely, the tides are turning on this. But how do we even know about hypnosis? Where does it come from? And this gets us into some very, very interesting territory. If we go back into a period just before the French Revolution and right around the time of the American Revolution, there's a lot of interesting ideas floating around. Swedenborg, for example, is a leading character. And Swedenborg, he comes out of Sweden. He is this incredibly well-respected academic who starts to have these basically wide-awake mystical experiences with God. And he becomes also well-known for predicting events. You know, he predicts large-scale fires and things of this nature. What's happening there is there's this kind of underpinning that there's going to be a large-scale awakening that goes beyond the Enlightenment into something else. And figures like this are turning up, and they're unusual. You know, if you go back and look at Swedenborg, you can look at that period and say, he's so unusual when he comes out of the blue, very much like Blavatsky when she shows up in the 19th century. But what he is suggesting, and this is where I get tie-overs and crossovers from Swedenborg and people like Mesmer and Cagliostro, is they all seem to be thinking about flight. Now, we know Da Vinci thought a good deal about flight, and you could say these guys were picking up on that. However, we didn't know that Da Vinci was thinking about flight until the 19th century discoveries of some of his works. Those other versions of flying machines and things weren't there. So these guys were getting their own inspirations. One of the ones I was tackling that will set us up nicely for this is the Swedenborg flying machine, which I'm going to read us a little bit about. This is quite fascinating, and how the flight aerospace aspect takes flight with the kind of large-scale revelations. The two are related in a very unusual way. There's no direct tie-over, and yet the same players are very often involved. Swedenborg 1714 flying machine. It was first sketched by the Swedish scientist. This thing looks like a flying egg. And we've seen a lot of UFOs that look exactly like this. So, you know, this is the kind of thing where we need to keep this in mind, that he's already envisioning this. And you have to wonder, if he's thinking this up in 1714, you know, why couldn't somebody have developed this outside of normal channels? And that's responsible for some, at least some, of what we see in the department of UFOs. And that is the term, by the way, UFO. UAP is a CIA sham. Emanuel Swedenborg put these together in 1714 when he was 26. This was 20 years before his mystical revelations. It was later published in his periodical Daedalus Hyperboreus in 1716. And so, you know, like I said, Da Vinci did do some stuff before him about flying machines, but they weren't even out. So this is totally original. Swedenborg's flying machine was not widely known until his notebook containing the sketch was discovered in 1867. All right, so his stuff is also underground for 150 years. So these guys, it seems like we only get to their flight stuff 150 years after these secret societies have been able to work on it. By a visiting researcher from the United States, it's referred to as the manuscript. The published account, when Swedenborg returned to Sweden in 1714, he met with inventor Christopher Pullum, and together with him published the periodicals Daedalus Hyperboreus. When Swedenborg mentioned publishing the flying machine, Pullum was skeptical as to whether it was possible to build the machine. He compared it to building a perpetual engine, but Swedenborg replied with a quote by French author Bernard Fontenelle, "The art of flying is hardly yet born. It will be perfected, and people will fly up to the moon." This is gifted insight, shall we say, to say the least. I have a picture of the original sketch and of the egg itself. This is the actual flying egg that Swedenborg developed. Now, if you take a little walk around here in Harvard Square, you're going to find the Swedenborg Chapel. If you walk a little further downtown on Newbury Street, you're going to find the Swedenborg Reading Room. Over here is the Swedenborg Reading Library. And you're going to find that a lot of the experts and people who set up Harvard were all heavy-duty Swedenborgians. But there's his original sketch of this flying egg, and I have to say, it makes the case for a very early flying saucer.
Did any physicists or like astrophysicists try to build that?
It's pretty interesting because his material publicly was tucked away. We don't have public records, but what I'm trying to put across is that more than likely this was developed in secret circles for 150 years before it was brought back out. When we get into mesmerism and early versions of mesmerism with Mesmer, we'll find that the people who were doing these flying balloons for the first time in, you know, we're talking 1780, they're going out there and, you know, doing pretty good voyages across France and all the rest. They're really getting it down to a science. And this is associated with mesmerism. As a matter of fact, some of the original pamphlets that Mesmer would put out had him standing, aiming at the moon and the moon's energy coming back down and these kind of balloon flying in the background there. These things I find very telling. And there's an overlap, which I don't think has been studied, that I think when we get to original aerospace and mysticism, that's emerging there in the 18th, 19th century, then we start to understand the mystery school's influence, because the mystery schools never lost the key to flight or anything else. But somebody else was working in the background with this, which I think accounts, as I said, for some UFO sightings, not all by a long shot. So,
can I just throw this in there?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Lucy and Luna say, Mork from Ork had a flying egg UFO.
He did. it's true, and it's interesting how much of a craze for UFOs there was in the 1970s. There was a number of programs about it. And the whole space theme, I think, you know, was the space program and all the rest of it. But once you kind of went down on the space program, like by the early 70s, they stopped going to the moon. This other stuff comes up, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, aliens, Spielberg and aliens. So they're talking in deep levels in the background. Technical description. The image shows a flying machine from above looking down. It consists of one large wing. In the middle of it is a hole with a basket where the pilot stands. There are two paddles on the wings. These are used by the pilot. And except in the case where they only move up and down, underneath the ship is landing gear. It consists of four long poles. It's interesting because poles are going to bring us directly into the Mesmer conversation. I wanted to bring in the Swedenborg piece because what happens is when the mesmerism part hits and it turns into a craze of healing, where people are going in to be healed, you know, and the government feels like, oh, it's outside of our powers, then they throw in a commission to get rid of Mesmer and get rid of mesmerism. But it's spreading everywhere across France. And in every major city, when you read the accounts, there's a Mesmer network. And they're all over the place. Side by side with that, the Swedenborg movement is developing. And they're starting to merge and saying, you've got the magnetic healing here, one. And over here, we have this spiritualist Swedenborg teaching. Let's get together and make an entirely coherent movement. And this is what you're seeing. And it becomes such a threat to the French that they're thinking of anything to drive this guy out. And for a while, they do. I should say Mesmer was very well respected early on in Vienna. And his early theses are all about interstellar effects on human life here on Earth. So he's very keen on astrology. He's very keen on astronomy. His secret around animal magnetism, healing magnetism, it runs very deep, and I'm going to go into a deeper description of it here. One of the things that I think he put across, he never gave this secret away. So he would train somebody how to do it. Here's how you do, you know, the healing magnetism. But he would never say, here's the secret to how I know that. So it's my impression from studying Mesmer that when you're looking at Mesmer, you're looking at the same influence. Like, we don't know exactly where Blavatsky came out of. You don't know exactly where Gurdjieff came out of. You know, Gurdjieff, there's a thing where it says, well, he came out of the Sarmung Brotherhood. We know it was a mystery school. There's no question. We know that Blavatsky was trained in the mystery schools, but we don't know how to pinpoint which school and where. So it's the same thing with Mesmer. And what's funny is when I track all this stuff back, it all tracks back to Germany. And of course, the Steiner movement tracks back to Germany. And the person who initiates both Steiner and earlier, much earlier, Blavatsky into the mysteries is the same character, Mailander, who is a top Rosicrucian that Steiner would say, you know, Steiner, the founder of Theosophy, Anthroposophy, who we have done a number, a show for years on this program. If you're watching the X series, you know Rudolf Steiner and Anthroposophy, very important foundation for any mystical mystery understanding. He would say, oh, well, this character, you know, Christian Rosenkreutz, who comes forward and gives us the Rosy Cross, the Rosicrucian teaching, and basically is the reemergence of the mystery schools. He is embodied in Mailander. Basically, this is a reincarnation of Christian Rosenkreutz. So Mailander is very important character, and he is, you know, some people call him the last Rosicrucian, which I find interesting. So we have a situation there around Germany where, you know, there are these crossovers to people directly coming out of these mystery schools. I go to someone named Del Croz, and Del Croz was the person who helped bring the Gurdjieff movements to the public. So this series of movements that were so unusual, and he's this kind of fantastic dance instructor. But he also was doing Eurythmy with Rudolf Steiner. So here he is working on one hand, using his mystical interpretations with Eurythmy and Rudolf Steiner. And on the other hand, he's using his work for the Gurdjieff movements. So, and he's in Germany. And in fact, what happens is Gurdjieff is going to have his headquarters in Germany, and he gets thrown out of Germany. So he gets thrown out of a few places. They wonder about him. And I'll get into that why. I want to bring up Gurdjieff here for a moment, speaking of hypnosis. One of the things that happens in the book, there's two very big clues in the book, In Search of the Miraculous by P.D. Uspensky, about the mystery school that Gurdjieff came out of, but who he was before he went into that mystery school. One of the things that he discovered, he was kind of sworn to secrecy about, and he decided in the book not to reveal it. Later it comes out that he discovered that Gurdjieff was a stage hypnotist originally, and that Gurdjieff went about also treating people who were alcoholics, who had addictions and all the rest of it, through hypnosis. This same Gurdjieff would go into the mystery schools and come out, you know, supercharged with all this knowledge. And what he would bring forward is this system of types. You know, there's a huge system of the fourth way, but one of the things in that is the system of types that's embodied in the Enneagram, which he always called a moving diagram. It's in perpetual motion. And he would often have it aligned side by side with the musical scale. Now, the musical aspect in the Gurdjieff work is major. And it's not quite understood, but if you read And that's a shot of Gurdjieff in 1922 giving a lecture on the Enneagram. If you read the In Search of the Miraculous book, you'll see laid out that Gurdjieff's entire system of universal understanding is all based around the musical system. So, you know, sola, fa, sola, si, do. You know, look, we have this whole thing that he lists as the entire outline of universal elements and energies. And he's saying, look, the mystery schools at a certain point hid the universal knowledge, the kind of knowledge around perpetual motion and advanced energy and all the rest of it. They hid it in the musical scale. So that's why whenever you get around the Gurdjieff work, you get around talk about octaves. And this musical conversation is going to swing back to us heavily when we find out one of the major students of Mesmer was Mozart. And guess what? Mozart had been around Mesmer since he was 6 years old. Let's figure that one out. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. We're going deep tonight, very, very deep, on Mesmer, Mozart, secret magnetism, trance mystery. What is a somnambulist state? What is hypnosis, after all? Has it all been watered down through the psychological training? And has that educational process drained it of any real life? Well, Steiner thought so. He said something very interesting, which is he said, you know, what they did with hypnosis was they missed the core thing by laying out the details of how it worked. They said, well, this is what you do. They wanted to turn it into a book science. And he said, the entire thing relies on the magnetism of the hypnotist and the types interacting. This is what Mesmer was getting at. That's what's in that Enneagram. Remember, it's the nine types. And the types thing is a conversation that brings us into astrology through the 12 different zodiac signs and their different attributes and the way that certain people who are certain signs are supposed to get along with other people in certain signs. Right down to Christ and his disciples and how he has these 12 disciples around him and how they each represent a different aspect of humanity. The types question becomes absolutely crucial. And it's hidden here. The musical part is crucial, but it's hidden here. The hypnosis part is crucial, but it's hidden here. But you can start to get, if you go a little bit deeper, you can start to get, oh, here's how these things all line up. And if you take that impression that Steiner is giving, saying hypnosis is one of the deepest secrets of the mystery schools, why would that be? Well, one of the reasons is this whole bit, he gives a hint of it. He said the whole thing is about the person giving the hypnotic trance and the basically the types compatibility. This is crucial, and this is how we're going to open up this whole conversation. I'm going to read a quote about the Enneagram here before we go any further. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. Deep, deep here tonight. I want to mention as kind of a reminder, a hypnotic suggestion, that if you haven't already, especially if you're new here, go to darkjournalist.com, sign up for our newsletter. And that's the newsletter that keeps us in touch past the censorship, past Google, past all of it. And you'll get basically the newsletter once a week letting you know what's going on and the important things that are happening here on the show. The X-Series episodes, incredible episodes coming up for you that we're preparing for this summer. Events, documentaries. We just put out this incredible Atlantis documentary, Hacking Atlantis, and the craze in the hot zone. I've made that available for everyone right on this channel. And it's great feedback on that, but spread it far and wide because of the censorship around it is heavy duty. But that thing, you know, I've been hearing a lot of superficial conversations going on. And one thing I want to say is I appreciate a lot of work that's out there. And, you know, I try to bring as much of that work forward as I can. So once in a while, when you get into certain areas like Atlantis or the UFO file, I am kind of blown away at how the marketeering has dumbed down the material. And so one of the things I'm trying to put forward is a very potent message around these things. And I try, you know, with the work that we do and with the guests that we have and all the rest of it, this is the real keyword for us going forward in 2024 into the future. It's not this over-marketed, watered-down rehash of Anunnaki or something. You know, this is very potent stuff where all these things have a place. And, you know, we also understand what junk conspiracy is versus the real thing. And people have been trying to peddle junk conspiracy. We've been seeing a lot of that as well. So we have to have really good radar when it comes to these things. The thing is, this show and the points that we bring forward about the mystery schools, about ex-steganography, and about some of these major players on the mystical side, it is potent information. It's life-changing work. And I can tell you that because I've seen the effects of how that happens. And what I try to do is bring out and kind of synthesize some of the things that have been missed and not understood widely or misunderstood or mismarketed or something. And what happens is, when you get to that core, you can start to see, oh, here's where the real vital aspect, the vital piece of this is. When they're talking about this, you know, the eighth sphere, this is where the vital focus can go. To me, that's important, and that's why I call this part of it potent, and that's where we need to go, I think, with all of this. So that's what we try to do, and certainly keeping in touch with us through the newsletter is the best way for us to do that. So I'm glad that, you know, for the number of people who have signed up for the newsletter, it's the best way, because I always hear from people that you're not getting notifications or whatever through YouTube or any other social media platform. You know, we'll mail it to you directly. So do yourself a favor and stand up and be counted. And before I go any further, Miss Olivia, how's the room temperature out?
Good. Nanette Chris says that Saint Germain trained Mesmer and then went elsewhere to design trains, steamships, etc., saying, quote, it will be needed 150 years later in specific countries. And Danielle Jorgensen says Mozart's father was also a composer and a buddy of Mesmer.
Exactly. And what we know about their relationship is the letters between his father and Mozart, you know, writing to his dad and being like, you know, this and that about Mesmer. It's very, very interesting because at the time they know him, he's not doing the Mesmer magnetism craze. It's pre that. He's writing about interstellar influences. He's writing about astronomy. He's writing about how the stars influence humanity on the earth. And he's getting into energies, and they're thinking there at these universities in Vienna, huh, this guy is very interesting, but he's very outside the box. So already he's garnered that reputation. And by the time he's in France with his great discovery around magnetism, he's either thought of as a lunatic or as such an innovator that it's kind of like the California Gold Rush and these people rush to him. And he really creates a movement that for a decade there, you know, explodes through Europe and is right there in the heart of the French Revolution and the whole revolutionary period. And it is certainly related. As a matter of fact, characters from the American Revolution, like Benjamin Franklin, are sent in as kind of, you know, observers, medical commission observers, to try to knock it and take it down. And in some ways, Franklin does participate in that, although, you know, he seems to be doing it as kind of a public political thing. I'm going to read this quote about the Enneagram, and I'm going to tie this back musically, and then we're going to go next directly into Mesmer and his magnetism. Here is what Gurdjieff had to say about the Enneagram, and see if we can get to the core of some of these issues, including the flight connection with hypnosis. The Enneagram is perpetual motion, the same perpetual motion that men have sought since the remotest antiquity and could never find. And it is clear why they could not find perpetual motion. They sought outside themselves that which was within them. And they attempted to construct perpetual motion as a machine is constructed, whereas real perpetual motion is a part of another perpetual motion and cannot be created apart from it. The Enneagram is a schematic diagram of perpetual motion, that is, of a machine of eternal movement. But, of course, it is necessary to know how to read the diagram. The understanding of this symbol and the ability to make use of it gives humanity very great power. It is perpetual motion, and it is the philosopher's stone of the alchemists. The knowledge of the Enneagram has for a very long time been preserved in secret, and it is now, so to speak, made available to all through Gurdjieff bringing it out. It is only in an incomplete and theoretical form of which nobody could make any practical use without instruction from a man who knows. In order to understand the Enneagram, it must be thought of as in motion, as moving. A motionless Enneagram is a dead symbol. The living symbol is in motion. Some of the most crucial quotes there from Gurdjieff about the Enneagram. Very interesting in this also, which is he's saying, you know, they're so busy looking for this technological device. It's actually what operates inside of them. And in order to get to be able to use that, they have to basically become aware and resonate with this thing that they're a part of. So it's not like you can construct it on its own and have it be complete. Now, it's very interesting because Gurdjieff is very into all these technological innovations, but what he's very against is the mechanical quality by which humanity is becoming more and more the tool of these, you know, and he's up close there in World War One, World War Two, earlier wars, the Russian Revolution, where he sees how, you know, the propaganda and the brainwashing turns these people into machines. And he's saying, oh, the technology is getting more and more advanced, and they're using airplanes to blow each other up. And you know, he's watching the development of atomic power, and he's saying these sleeping machines are going to destroy themselves and everything else. So the Gurdjieff work comes out of this mystical tradition as part of that. You know, I'm writing in to kind of feed the culture this piece. And I've always felt that Gurdjieff was kind of a mystery school experiment because he was dynamic enough to get it out there, but he was also dynamic enough and conflicted enough to drive the right people away. So it was a, kind of a roll of the dice in a way. And I think people like Ouspensky, who brought so much of his work out, but split with him because of who he was. And, you know, the kind of game playing and the excessive acting and things that Gurdjieff would do as lessons. But after a certain point, you know, people wanted to be taken as equals. And so Gurdjieff, you know, one of the things that Ouspensky said about Gurdjieff was that he had boiled himself down. You know, he created this whole system about a wheel of eyes and how people are on this wheel of eyes and shocks from the outside, these accidents, bring out different aspects of personality. Now, it's very interesting because when we get into early hypnosis, and I'm going to get into that with Pusseger, and what he learned from Mesmer and what real hypnosis is. What we get into, though, is very interesting because what we're seeing is that Gurdjieff is saying a certain aspect of the personality in the character, the different eye, is operating. And so that's the extravagant eye. It goes out and it buys a bunch of stuff. And then this other eye is stuck working to pay the bill. So different parts of our personality. And unless you kind of unify those eyes into a particular aim, they wander around and a person's life becomes a mishmash of different influences. And it's very interesting because what Ouspensky said was, you know, Gurdjieff was really advanced, but the thing was he had boiled himself down to two eyes left. One very, very good, like kind of spiritual master, and this other one who was kind of a genius at making trouble for people. And so, you know, I think the challenges go right along up the ladder of spiritual advancement. But Gurdjieff had a lot to say about Mesmer, as did Blavatsky, as did Steiner. And they all hearken back and say, oh, you know, Mesmer, he found it. He found it. And they don't mention the school that he came out of or the particular thing that he found. But, you know, they, if you read it, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandfather and Gurdjieff, you can find those mentions of Mesmer. And they're like, huh, these are very interesting little things that he's saying about Mesmer. Same with Blavatsky, who puts a great deal of emphasis on Mesmer. They understand it coming out of that mystery tradition, that Mesmer has laid out something very crucial that was missed and suppressed by the French medical institution of the time. Let's see if I've guessed what it is they've missed, and we can use Mozart and Pussegger to bring us to this as well. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. Mesmer, Mozart, Secret Magnetism, Trance Mystery Revealed. Somnambulism is in here. Remember the somnambulist trances of Emma Britton through the Orphic Circle in the presence of people like Charles Dickens when she was giving these incredible trance readings. I want to go into a few of these trance things out of spiritualism and then jump into the magnetism first. Before I do that, Miss Olivia?
McP Scientific Mystic says Mesmer was literally Wolfgang's godfather.
Mm-hmm.
And has Hatpauser says, so basically it sounds like Mesmer was a guy who could control the frequency of the room, like Jesus and other masters.
Yes. Well, it's interesting. Jesus did a lot of hands-on healing. And, you know, prayer circles and all this kind of things, they utilized that. Christian Science utilized this a great deal. And you find a large-scale movement around New Thought in the 19th century is all about how your mind can keep you well. Positive affirmations. They're understanding something about the mind that it's a very suggestible thing. And a lot of people wonder about this, but there's something very malleable about humanity on a spiritual scale. And so the idea that our unconscious would be open to suggestion makes sense in the developmental curve. But what suggestion actually is, and how deep that suggestion goes, you know, it's very interesting. It's like that scene in Star Wars where Obi-Wan is saying, these aren't the droids you're looking for, move along, and all the rest of it. And the security guards move along and they let Luke and Obi-Wan go. And Luke says, what's going on here? You know, what'd you do? And he said, the Force has the ability to, you know, basically get past the weak-minded. And, you know, so there's this understanding about how living in an automatic state makes you suggestible. And marketing relies on the fact that people are suggestible. You know, your hair's too long, your hair's not long enough. Eat meat all the time, you know, the keto people, right? You see this push all the time. You have to eat meat nonstop in order to be healthy. And then vegans, oh, you can't eat any meat or you won't be healthy. You're going to get every kind of suggestion in the world, but somewhere there's a balance there that's right. And I think balance is the key word there. But nonetheless, anyone is going to know how to sell you something for, you know, whatever they specify. And you have to understand that, and I think particularly with women when they're growing up and the pressures of society and the whole modeling cosmopolitan Victoria's Secret culture puts them in all kinds of suggested places as well. Right now we have a heavy-duty emphasis in the society. That's where you get all the trans stuff, you know, and we hear all kinds of people trying to break this down and figure out what on earth is going on here, you know, and this is somebody's attempt to mold and shape the culture through suggestion. So the more you become aware, the more immune you are to the suggestion, you come out of their dream, and you start to get into your own awareness again. This is very important. So when we take, if we can kind of deprogram ourselves, then, you know, we start to end up in a different place. I actually say that it's more about taking the right suggestion, because I believe we're always suggestible. And what's interesting is, you know, because there's a loop here with Mesmer, Casey, Gurdjieff, and Blavatsky. And it works something like this, which is, in the Casey work, one of the things the reading source told him about himself was that he was one of the most suggestible people on the planet at the time. Meaning that he was able to take these suggestions to go into the psychic state, go into the Akashic record, find this information, bring it back about the past lives of individuals, about the physical condition of individuals, about the retrocognitive, world of the past, and be able to be pointed there through suggestion, like in a remote viewing session, but deeper, extract the information, bring it back. So there is a suggestibility, and it's interesting because at times, you know, they would ask Casey, well, you know, where'd you, how did you have the ability to do all this in his psychic state? And, through these successive lives, he had developed this incredible ability. But one of those times was just as a soldier, he learned the ability to take orders. So because he was used to taking orders in that lifetime, he developed the ability to do that. So when he was lying there in trance and people were giving him orders to go do things, he would go do it, but he would do it psychically. This is, I think, important and gets at some of the hints of suggestibility. By the way, Casey used affirmation and suggestion multiple times in his reading. You know, he would sometimes say for different ailments, you know, tell the person, instruct the person that their circulation is improving. Instruct the person's mind that they're going to sleep easier. Instruct the person's mind, especially as they're going to sleep. So he's playing there with that state. But remember, it's that state that got him into the trance in the first place. So let's use him as an example and then backtrack through him, through Emma Britton, directly to Mesmer and this character named Victor, who was really the key, I think, to this whole program. So in Casey's situation, he had been struck. He had unusual encounters already as a child, all the psychic manifestations, seeing his grandfather and all the rest of it. But he had been struck during a baseball game by a baseball bat on his spinal column when he was about 13. And that whole day he acted very bizarrely, you know, stood on roofs, yelled, walked in traffic, did all kinds of crazy things. And when they got him at home, they told a doctor and said, what's going on here? And he couldn't really figure it out. And Casey started speaking in a very deep voice. And he said, if you put the questions to me about what's wrong with this individual, I can give you, you know, basically a remedy and a solution. And so they say, okay, you know, what's happening here? What's going on? And he recommends that they put together an onion poultice and put it beneath the back of his head to reduce the swelling that's happened. And he goes into this whole thing and he gives this very erudite explanation of his condition. That is actually the first Edgar Casey reading when he's 13. Later, he will lose his voice. And there was a hypnotist that he knew named Al Lane, who said, well, I can try to put you into a trance and you recover your voice. I'll give you a suggestion to recover your voice. And so Casey, he's trying to put him into trance or whatever, and Casey starts to talk before he's in the full trance. There's something about the Casey trance which goes past that period where you'd be under hypnotic induction. So it's just before you would go into that hypnotic sleep, something else happens with him. And they said that his eyes would move and he would breathe in an unusual fashion. Well, this is very interesting because what happens is he tells the hypnotist, oh yeah, there's a circulation problem and he has all these strains on his vocal cords. What we can do is you can give me the suggestion to increase the circulation to my throat and I'll be fine. And what happens is he gives him the suggestion, you know, increase the circulation to your throat. Casey's throat turns red and he wakes up and he coughs up a little blood. And then after 9 months of not being able to speak at the age of 19, there he can speak again. And people hear about this and then they're like, well, you know, I have this problem. Maybe you can put him in a trance or whatever. And then after a while, he just starts putting himself into this trance. And it became important actually for someone he trusted to be able to give him the instructions for how to go into the trance, what they were looking for, et cetera. It helped things a lot. But this is how the whole Casey thing took off originally. And at the time, he wasn't aware that there were other people or, you know, people in the past who had this ability. Now, I think the Casey story is particularly telling because of the amount of information he was able to get and bring forward. That it started with health readings and it started with this whole piece, and then it moved into life readings, then it moved into universal consciousness, and they could ask him about anything. And they said, how deep does this information go? And he said, you can ask instructions about anything from fishing to writing a concerto. It's tapping into that universal mind. At another point, they asked him and they said, where's this information coming from? And he said, from the unconscious mind of the person asking. So all unconscious minds are connected. This is another key understanding of these people involved around the mystery schools. And once we get to that, we start to understand, aha, this is what's going on. But let's remember this. Casey is in trance. He's in a somnambulist trance, getting suggestions. If we move back a little bit, and remember, it's a hypnotist that brings it out with Casey through suggestion. Well, Gurdjieff was also a hypnotist. He discovered a number of things as a hypnotist. Hypnosis is deeply involved. Helena Blavatsky learned Eastern hypnosis, where she could put an entire room into a mesmerized state. So hypnosis, but see, it's funny because what we understand as hypnosis is this kind of thin sliver, suggestion, interaction. Where does it really come from? That's where the mesmer key is so important with Pusseguer and his experiences with the peasant Victor. That's what we're going to get to next. Everyone, you're watching The Dark Journalist Show. This is Mesmer, Mozart, Secret Magnetism, Trance Mystery Revealed. Somnambulism is in there. We're going to do this next section on mesmer, then take your questions. Miss Olivia, what do you got?
Thomas Ball says, I tried reading a book about self-hypnosis, but it kept putting me to sleep.
Well, sleep's pretty good. Sleep's pretty good. If you can put yourself to sleep through suggestion, that's not bad. A lot of people that I know, when they tried meditation, they sleep. And, you know, I think that's part of it. I don't think that there's any problem with that. I remember when Gladys Davis talked about Casey, she said when they were giving him the suggestion, at a certain point, he would breathe funny right in his chest, heavily up and down, and his eyeballs were going back and forth with his eyes closed. And she said she knew that that's when you catch him and you make the suggestion and all the rest. And if you didn't, he'd go to sleep. He'd just pass out. So there was some window there for him to get into that particular state, which I think is a crucial difference. I don't think, I want to go on the record with this, because I've read a lot of traditional psychology around hypnosis. You know, they don't understand it at all. As a matter of fact, the person who did understand it, Charcot, had the medical background to bring it into the field. And originally, psychology was going to hold that. And then they booted Charcot out and they went with very flimsy stuff instead. And that's what you ended up with psychology. But really, any competent person looking at the history of this will tell you the entire patient-therapist relationship comes directly out of the mesmer work. That's very important. So they gave us a great deal there, but they could have given us a great deal more had traditional science, traditional medicine allowed for that. But there was a lot of jockeying there for power and position, and we missed out, like we do on a lot of things, because somebody likes to hold that information back. These groups are used to, when information of a higher level comes in, you know, basically keeping it behind the veil. And we've seen a lot of that. And when it breaks through, you know, you have to be careful with it for sure. But I think it's a better outcome for it to break through to a wider populace. And that's why the craze of mesmerism becomes so wild. All right.
Can I actually interrupt you with a question?
Yes.
So I'm thinking about Mozart, and if Mesmer was his godfather, I mean, as a child, he'd have innate talent. He would have come in with it because it was in his genes, but could Mesmer have tweaked him to become more advanced, like a genius, but prodigy, with mesmerism?
Well, it's interesting because it goes back to, you see, Mesmer was very, very interested in the cosmos, but he didn't demonstrate the magnetic aspect until later. And so I think, if anything, he took a deep interest in Beethoven and in Mozart. And, you know, like for me, when I think about that whole thing about their relationship between Mesmer and Mozart, you have to really look at it and say, what is the basis of this? Like, and so there's a personal relationship, but at a certain point, I think that it's more Mozart coming to him and being like, I'm fascinated by your discoveries of this magnetism thing. And then that gets us into Mozart and some of the things he does with mystical masonry music. So Masonic hymns and things of this nature. That's something that he's going to dedicate himself to in the 1880s. It's very unusual, and I'm not sure that people even put that together very often with Mozart. For our purposes here, we're going to keep it in the realm of Mesmer and what he did there, but there may be something bigger as well that we'll bring forward about Mozart and the Masons. It's a little teaser there. Okay, a couple of things about Mesmer. Franz Anton Mesmer, born in 1734 in a region known as Swabia, located near Lake Constance. His father served as a gamekeeper, forester, and he had a Jesuit education. His studies continued in philosophy, and the family, you know, wanted him to be in the priesthood and all this stuff. He was not interested, but he was interested in getting becoming a doctor of medicine. And it's 1766, which let's look at this. It puts him at 32 years of age that he writes his thesis and the degree, the doctor of medicine. And it's all about the influence of the planet on physical humanity. He was intrigued by the theoretical possibility that the gravitational forces of the universe influenced the health of humanity. He formulated nature's philosophy. Now, so he's already weird coming out of the box. And the magnetism piece, this is not, you know, they will try to paint him as a charlatan and all the rest of it. The magnetism healing has so many people on record saying that it worked, that whatever it was that he discovered certainly worked. Now, later it became the kind of thing where somebody would come, you know, in for a little while, study with him, and then go do it themselves. And so it may have been watered down, and maybe, you know, there were reasons for them to want to kind of regulate it, as it were. But there's no suggestion that he was ever doing this as part of, charlatan activity at all. As a matter of fact, it's Marie Antoinette herself who gets very involved when they start to boot him out of France. And she's like, look, you know, let's bring him back. And she goes and she offers him a salary if he'll stay in France. So she was very, very convinced of what he was doing. And later people like Dickens, who, you know, would work with the Orphic Circle and other things that people aren't aware of. I've been bringing them up about Dickens for a while. Very, very mystical there. he is absolutely obsessed with and a major promoter later on of mesmerism. So Mesmer marries a rich widow, Anna Maria von Posch, a woman of noble descent living in a mansion in Vienna. The marriage provided him with the wealth and status he could not have easily attained. The relatives had reservations about him because he was younger. And
this is a theme that comes up a lot.
It is, the older woman in that period. But it's also true with Uspensky.
Exactly.
Yeah, and Bennett. Bennett's wife was 20 years older than he was, J.G. Bennett. So there's some,
sugar mama.
There's some sugar mama there. What's interesting about this, I think, is there's a mention here about Mesmer cultivating performances on the glass harmonica. Now, there's another crisscross here because Benjamin Franklin develops the glass harmonica, which is this incredible instrument with a series of kind of glass bowls. And Franklin, of course, comes up later trying to basically, you know, be the voice of reason in this commission that's trying to get rid of Mesmer and mesmerism entirely. And he, you know, he shows up as a little bit of a voice of reason, but he also joins in the party of getting rid of mesmerism, unfortunately. And Thomas Jefferson at one point writes an essay saying, look, you know, if mesmerism comes to America, we'll create laws to outlaw it. These were guys, it's very interesting because with their own mystical knowledge, they know what they're working with here. And what they're seeing in mesmerism is something that is has the ability to be this kind of out of control movement. And, you know, this is what they're getting in France. It's funny because this is exactly the kind of thing I think that is crucial. And, you know, very often government structures don't like it when, you know, the citizens are doing their own thing and developing their own results and that they don't need the top. And it's very funny because you have, you know, Franklin and Jefferson, the ultimate, you know, founding fathers about freedom and all the rest of it. And even they are afraid of the craze of mesmerism. But that is the glass harmonica there. And the most incredible sound, I highly recommend you check out any samples of a glass harmonica because it'll put you in a very good or very interesting mood right away. What's funny is it got this reputation after a while. They were like, oh, you know, it puts people in this kind of melancholy mood. So they try to ban it. Can you imagine how repressive is that? But he stuck by it and he pushed it. And it's interesting because it will be Mesmer who becomes a real expert at it and does, you know, his little concertos there on the glass harmonica. Now, I do feel that when we get into a few things about Franklin and Mesmer, I just want to say this for the record, that I found some quotes from Franklin about Mesmer directly, which is always better than what people say about him. And let's see what that is. Franklin commented about mesmerism, noting that if methods persuaded patients to take less medicine, they might have been better off. This was one of the problems, since the establishment medical community relied heavily on its pharmacopoeia. The commission, which proceeded quite logically, focused on the validity of Mesmer's theories of animal magnetism, objectively testing in what was quite literally a series of blinded tests the ability of patients to perceive these forces. So they created a kind of a false version of this, and they were like, it doesn't work. That was the, you know, their final bit on it. And they tried to put it away. But what happened was when they booted him out of France, it started to take off in Vienna. And then he got welcomed back into France through Marie Antoinette. So they lampooned him. They did theater shows. This is a real propaganda campaign against him. They did comedy theater shows with like a phony Mesmer doing this stuff and, you know, making passes at the women and things of this nature. So they were really trying to get him out. Here's what Mesmer was looking for. He's saying that there's a universal magnetic fluid or force that could be found in and have a physical effect on all living things. This is the central core of his thesis. Therefore, by manipulating the fluid with magnets, one can manipulate the body into being well again, a universal cure for any disease. Now, this is a great goal he has right off the bat. So originally, he's using magnets. And then people are wearing magnets at different parts of the body. And then the magnets themselves do the trick. After a while, he realizes, I am the magnet. This is important. And
Say that again.
After a while, he realizes, I am the magnet.
I just think that should be like our mantra. It's like a power mantra.
And he teaches people how to be the magnet for the magnetic healing. So he actually starts to say, you know what? Wait a minute. I'll magnetize this object. And here's this stick, and it's magnetized. You know, you're off. Hold the stick, and you've got the cure. And then he was like, you know, this is interesting. I'm seeing a lot of people doing this. You know, it's kind of like when people go to see a chiropractor. It's like, hey, I'm here for my magnetic mesmerism, animal magnetism session. And so he goes forward and he says, you know, okay, I'm seeing a lot of you now. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to put a big pool of water here in the middle of this, and I'm going to magnetize the water. And anyone who touches the water basically is going to get the effect of the magnetic healing. And then they had the whole thing with metal rods and all the rest of it. And it was working like crazy. People would say, well, my arthritis is gone. You know, my stomach problems are gone. My headaches are gone. You know, and it developed exactly like this, and it became kind of a craze. And so he set up a number of people with the method, but not the secret of how he got the method. And they all started to be able to do the magnetism. So it's becoming this incredible thing. Here's an early picture of Mesmer doing the magnetism. And you can't really see it because it's getting... the light is blocking it out, but from his hands is flowing, the right hand is flowing a certain amount of magnetic energy, and from the left hand also. And when these sessions are done, the people are better. So he's using the magnetic energy directly, and he's grown beyond the magnets now. He's using himself as the magnet. Now, the controversies happen, you know, they try to get rid of him. He is cutting directly into that French medical establishment. There's a royal thing where it's said, oh, you know, some of the royals actually really like this guy. And like, you know, the other royals are like, we have to get rid of him. So there's an incredible backstory there. I'm going to do a kind of a shorthand version of it. What happens, what I think is crucial to understanding the mystery side of all this, is that one of the marquee de Peyseguir comes forward and becomes one of his best pupils. And what happens, and one of the things that was they were able to use against Mesmer, is that when people would go to a certain point of the healing, they would have something called a healing crisis, which was kind of like a fit, a convulsion, a migraine. Once they would get past that, they'd be like, I'm great. But that effect itself became the focal point of the criticism and the things that they could use against him. And so now we get to the Marquis de Peyseguir. Now, this is a very important person who's often left out of the picture. He's crucial to the development, real development of true hypnosis, true psychology. And there's a big esoteric piece left behind. His real name was Armand Marie Jacques de Chastenay. And he was a royal, part of the British, part of the French royal family. So it's undeniable the abilities, you know, the background that this guy had. He was incredibly well trained. But once he hooks up with Mesmer, a whole new world opens up to him. And he says, oh my goodness, I can't believe what this guy is doing. Now, what he does is he makes a series of diary entries that become the basis of a book called Animal Magnetism. And what he finds is that there's a peasant named Victor who was basically like a servant in the royal house who had migraine headaches. And when he put Victor into a trance using the magnetism, he could give him suggestions, and that he didn't have any kind of healing crisis. And he got past this portion of the healing crisis thing by just giving him a suggestion. So one of the suggestions when he had pneumonia was that they figured out that he needed to sweat. So they said, you're at a party and you're dancing, you know, and they're giving him this suggestion. His body starts to, perspire. And by the end of it, he's feeling a lot better. Now, the experiments with Victor go deeper and deeper and deeper to a certain point where Victor is starting to give him instructions in a different voice and using very erudite medical terms. So he's tapped into a different level of Victor's subconscious that knows it all and can give him instructions on how to heal. This is unusual. This is something he didn't expect. But once he gets rolling on this, he's like, oh my God, all the people that are doing the magnetism may have this ability. I may be able to open their unconscious up so they can give us these different insights into these remedies. And at a certain point, he says that he develops basically 60 Victors. People who are coming in, and they were coming in for treatment, for a mesmer treatment, and he's giving them the suggestion, and then they are treating themselves, and then they are giving him information. So there's a whole psychic information network that Paisaguer is developing. Now, think about Edgar Cayce for a moment. Let's go back to Cayce. Cayce, in a hypnotic somnambulist trance, goes into a level where his subconscious can reach out and he's amenable to suggestion. And these questions get asked, and he's able to give them the answers. This is exactly the process that's taking place back here with the magnetizer, Paisaguer. But it starts with Victor, and I want us to get a little bit, Victor Race is the guy's name. I want to read a little bit about Victor because I see echoes of Edgar Cayce and I see echoes of Emma Britton in there. We'll do that, summarize the Mozart section and take your questions.
Okay.
Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. Mesmer, Mozart, Secret Magnetism, Trance Mystery Revealed. Here is the core of the trance mystery, right in the work of Paisaguer. Victor Race appeared to have an alternate personality within him. This is an overview. This is actually not Paisaguer writing this. This is an overview of Paisaguer's book. Victor Race appeared to have an alternate personality within him, which emerged when he was in a magnetic sleep. That's hypnosis. That's what they called it then. Paisaguer's discovery of magnetic sleep and the alternate personality state introduced a radically new view of the human psyche. The importance of the discovery cannot be overestimated. Magnetic sleep revealed that the psyche is divided and that there exists a deeper level of insight quite different from everyday consciousness. The second level displays personality characteristics unlike those of the conscious state in judgments and mental acuity. The second unconscious psyche possesses its own memory chain with continuity of memory and identity from one episode of magnetic sleep to the next. In other words, I sit you back down, Victor, after I give you this suggestion, and you tell me everything that you did in the last session. You're still tapped into that universal information. Now, this is interesting. Here is Paisaguer in his own words. He says, I believe in the existence within myself of a power. From this belief derives my will to exert it. The entire doctrine of animal magnetism is contained in the two words, believe and want. I believe that I have the power to set into action the vital principle of my fellow men. I want to make use of it. This is all my science and by all my means. Believe and want, sirs, and you will do as much as I have done. Pisiger in 1785, and he accomplished a great deal, in fact. And he was adamant that it could only be used for ethical purposes. And he said it was so important for the operator to be ethical because it could defeat and actually unravel the entire subject. At a certain point, he decides to take Victor and, you know, have him on kind of medical display for doctors to come in and observe him and all the rest. But what happens is, in the background, someone takes Victor and puts him on stage, and they're giving him suggestions, and he's kind of entertaining the audience, and his health starts to go down dramatically. So Pisiger doesn't understand what's going on, and he says, Victor, let's have a magnetism session immediately. I'll put you under. You can tell me what's going on. And what the source inside Victor says is, when you put me out to display, I'm subject to all of this magnetism. And so you can't do that, basically. And it wasn't Pisiger that was doing this anyway, but he's telling him, this isn't the way, you know, basically this has to be done by ethical people in a very tight circle. And you can't have it as kind of like a public display thing, because all different types of magnetism enters in and actually disrupts his body. So this gives us, again, hints, clues about magnetism and what they're suggesting is going on here. The incredible thing is, what he says is that Victor is so erudite when he's in these trance sessions that he's, you know, he can't recognize him, because when he's conscious, he's a peasant servant. Now, here's what's interesting, and what I think is the crucial factor when you get into the deep mystery of Mesmer, Victor, and Pisiger. At a certain point, he is asking Victor to hum a waltz, and he'll hum the first few bars, and he'll say, repeat those bars, and Victor will hum the waltz. And they get into this whole musical back and forth. At a certain point, he decides to take a chance and only think the next set of bars. And when he thinks the next set of bars, that is Pisiger as the operator of the session, Victor starts to sing the bars that he's thinking. So he demonstrates in the hypnotic trance direct telepathy. This is the off-the-charts discovery of Pisiger. And it takes mesmerism in this whole complete direction. He has a whole worked out piece there. Well, guess what happens to Pisiger? The revolution's going down and everything else, and you know what? They throw him in jail for 2 years. And when he comes back out, maybe privately, he's still developing things, but we never get to the depth of the animal magnetism telepathic work that was left on the cutting room floor. And this incredible breakthrough of hypnotic telepathy from a higher source of the subconscious. This is the great deep mystery coming forward. And my read on it goes something like this. Mesmer came directly out of a mystery tradition there in Germany. He developed this magnetism ability. The schools had decided to let it out, and the medical institutions crushed it. And then these offshoots who couldn't be touched originally, like Pisiger, kept working on their own. And he got to such a point with it that he could have developed an actual science of telepathy that was demonstrable, far beyond the kind of thin psychology that we have now. It would have been a totally different, completely accepting of psychic ability. It would have been a transformation in society we can't even imagine. There are these figures standing right on the edge of it. And in the middle of it all, you have Mozart being this understudy, completely obsessed with mesmerism, and going from town to town promoting mesmerism with his mentor, Mesmer. Now, What gets interesting to me is the presence of music, just like the presence of music in the Enneagram and in the Gurdjieff system, and how Gurdjieff is saying, you know, Pythagoras, one of the things that he does is he sets the Western schools off to hide some of these advancements about universal realities directly in the musical scale, the Western music scale. And here we have basically the greatest classical composer of all time working directly with Mesmer, bringing forward now an opera that he's writing. And he goes forward and he writes this incredible piece, and I'm going to read something from it, but right in the middle of it is a character who is Dr. Mesmer, and he is doing his magnetic mesmerizing in the actual play. Quite remarkable indeed, and that there's a little piece about Cagliostro in there. So we'll get to all that. It might take another session for us to get into that whole piece, but now we're going to go to your questions.
Oh my God, Olivia. Where do I start? Okay, so Jessica Rodriguez says, yes, too many people's frequencies can disrupt certain people and their own frequency. Can we talk about spiritual disciplines, developing the will, and developing your magnetism? So, like, yeah. They don't frame it that way, but it would happen.
Well, look, someone can be a very good writer, for example, and if they don't have support around it, or if they get yelled at, things of this nature, then it can throw them off from bringing this thing through. On the other hand, if they're supported and the environment is created for them to bring this talent through, then we see great results. So a lot of these things at their core have to do with focus. Even the sessions of magnetism and hypnosis and all the rest of it require a kind of focus, like any early hypnosis thing. You know, the earliest ideas of hypnosis is you watch the little pendulum swing and you go into the state and they ask you questions, you fall asleep. When you wake up, you've said all these incredible things. So there's an understanding. There's like what I would call a really basic understanding in people generally that there's something else that can be tapped into there. They know for a fact when they put somebody in a hypnotic trance that they can, for example, recall when they lived on a street when they're 5 years old and the events of a particular day or whatever it happens to be. So your subconscious stores those memories. I think what's going on, the suggestion, shall we say, from people like Steiner and Blavatsky and others, is that there's a relationship between these subconscious minds, and that if you have a person who is conducting the hypnotic session, who is basically has the ability to open up that subconscious mind, then that subconscious talent, you know, it's created the environment, I can freely flow as that subconscious talent. It's the same thing as, you know, cultivating the ability for somebody to write, do music, or be in the arts, or whatever it happens to be. So for me, a lot of it is about the environment bringing forward and manifesting this kind of latent quality. So, but yeah, I mean, obviously, you need to be a little bit outside from the run of the world and the, you know, the craziness of social media and everything else. One of the things I love about the Gurdjieff work is that he said, well, this is the fourth way. The fourth way can only be done in the conditions of everyday life. So you can't go away to a monastery. You can't go to the mountains to a retreat center. You got to be in your life to do it. And I feel like that's the kind of evolutionary technique that we need at this point in time. Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking that developing willpower develops willpower, if you know what I mean. So
oh, yeah.
If you have the discipline to sit and meditate daily, or if, you know, to not eat this and not do that and, you know, but do things that are uncomfortable, that kind of daily practice of will then builds up your magnetism, which ultimately is willpower, or like it is.
Yes. Yeah. Know, I think there's a focus. There's a focus thing you're talking about. So it's the cultivation of a state of mind. And I want to make an odd entry into this whole conversation from Steiner himself. And then we'll take about 20 more minutes of your questions. This is the quote. And, you know, I want to say that there's a range of spiritualists, like the Fox sisters and Emma Brinton and others. The Fox sisters are very interesting in this because they have a natural psychic ability. But there's a suggestion there that Steiner is looking across at how the schools are using these people. And it almost seems to me like, you know, I'm like, I say to myself, well, how do the mystery schools know that the Fox sisters are psychic? How do they know about the Poughkeepsie Seal? Like, how do they know to bring these people forward? And there's all kinds of answers for that. But the impression that I got was almost like they were able to scan like a radio, you know, who's got the signal, basically. And it's very interesting how the masters, as it were, or the schools find their people. I remember Steiner's story. There was an illiterate gardener that was this incredible genius gardener with herbs and all the rest of it, spent all his time with them. But Steiner, when he was in school originally, was not a very good student, which is fascinating because he became such a genius. But through this kind of tutoring of Steiner into the sciences of the earth and things like that, Steiner became interested in geometry, studied geometry, and then became an off-the-charts genius as far as the rest of his studies were concerned. It unlocked his mind. But it's interesting to me because Felix the Gardener, you know, Felix the Gardener introduced him to the master that would initiate him into the mysteries. You know, it's interesting how they find them. I find that maybe something deep for study. Here's what Steiner has to say that gives us a hint about somnambulism and how it works and how this is related to theosophical ideas, astral body, etheric double, which I think are key things that were brought forward, not very well understood. Within the bodies I have just described, within the physical body, the etheric double and the astral body, within all of these is the actual I, or what we call a self. This is that in which we are conscious of ourselves. Of this, we say that we are it. This I itself has higher parts, which I will not say anything about today. Interesting, isn't it? It uses the higher parts of the human being as its tool. Once we understand how the human being is put together, we also gain a way of looking at the phenomena we encounter in somnambulism. Sleepwalking, essentially, is what the term means. It means I'm in a waking sleep. What is it that happens when we are in our usual clear waking consciousness? An impression of light is produced when etheric waves reach my eye. This impression is transformed by the astral body into an image of light, and this image of light becomes a representation. I become conscious of the image of light. Let us now assume that our eye has been turned off. Such shutting off occurs in ordinary sleep. You dream. I will not go into the question of where to look for the eye when we are asleep, leaving out the good part. But when we look at a sleeping person, what are we looking at? In the true sense of the word, only one whose spiritual eyes are open can give us a report about it. Such a person would see very precisely how this eye, joined with the astral body, has left the physical and the etheric bodies. Everyone knows in some way that we're asleep in the ordinary waking eye, the real eye is turned off, and their physical body and the etheric body double, holding it together, are left to their own devices. In ordinary waking life, whenever we receive impressions from the outer world, the I, our consciousness, is always present. We do not interact with the outer world without the waking eye that controls these impressions from the outer world. Presumably, when a clock ticks next to me when I'm asleep, it doesn't stop producing vibrations in the air, and those vibrations strike my eardrums. Now, do you think your ear is built differently in the daytime than in the nighttime? Of course not. All the things that happen to the physical body in the daytime keep happening when I'm asleep. But what is missing? What is missing is the penetration of the individual person by the I consciousness. So what he's saying is, in essence, the somnambulist has the ability there to let the conscious mind go and open up to this other deeper field of subconscious interaction. And what we have in the case of somebody being in a somnambulist state is they are, they're in a suggestive state where they can bring forward information, or they can actually bring forward a different personality. And the other thing that they could bring forward is a discarnate entity or an astral intelligence. So there are all these layers to this thing, but the way it's summarized in the Casey work is you have the conscious mind, you have the unconscious mind, then you have the superconscious mind. When you are in a conscious state, your unconscious, you know, that's the unconscious. That's the difference there. Conscious, unconscious. And then when you're in the unconscious state, the superconscious is the unconscious. So when I'm in dreams and things like that, and I get flashes of what's going to happen tomorrow, whatever, I'm tapping in to the superconscious. And of course, there are levels of dreams and all the rest. But nonetheless, I think it's important for us to keep in mind dreams versus hypnosis versus somnambulism versus thin, suggestible hypnosis on the surface. And somebody mentioned Dolores Cannon in there. What I want to mention about Dolores Cannon, I met Dolores Cannon, but she was very honest about what she was doing, which was she was trying to get an average person into a deep hypnotic state, ask them a bunch of questions about everything. But unfortunately, and I think it works against the material, is the subject, the people that she would get to ask the questions of, it didn't seem to me that they demonstrated any particular psychic abilities. And so it's like you're tapping the deep unconscious of a person who isn't really tuned in. So that's why I guess some of that you could take it or leave it. And some people find, you know, a lot of value in it, and that's good. But I haven't seen the same thing. When I go into, some of the deeper work around the mystery schools, you know, the value of it is instant. It reminds me, because sometimes, you know, you look at a Casey reading and somebody will ask him, you know, can you give me details around this particular incident, you know, and he'll go into a fight that took place in the Civil War and go into the casualties and the weather on that day and all the rest of it. And I don't expect everyone to be able to do that, but the kind of light presentation of things from somebody, it could easily be somebody tapping into their imaginative mind, and they don't seem to have very many details. So I think there's a great deal gradations of difference between really good tapping into the unconscious and just, you know, getting somebody's kind of anyhow version. So I think there is a way to bring somebody into a deep level to bring forward that information. And also the individual themselves needs to have that ability. So if they don't have the psychic ability right up front and you just put them into a trance, you're not going to get much. You're going to get what, Sue the author can do, or what, you know, George the executive can do. But that, you know, that's them in an unconscious state, yes. But do they have the ability? This is the question. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. This is Mesmer Mozart, Secret Magnetism Trance Mystery Revealed. We're going deep here with you tonight into the realms of Mesmer and Dipe Seguir. Mm-hmm. And we're going to take a few more questions from you here. And it's a deep, deep topic. And I'm going to bring the kind of cosmic concerto version up later in June. We're going to have an episode that rides right off of this one. Yes.
Cameron, DJ, can you talk more about what Steiner said about Mesmer and David Tormina? DJ, why do you think that Steiner warned so heavily against magnetic energy? Do you think he was referring to Mesmer's form of magnetic more so than the phenomenon of magnetism itself?
I would have to see exactly what you're referring to, because you have to get with Steiner a little bit too. Because, you know, Steiner is, he has the grasp of the topics. And there are times when, for example, he talks about dreams in this extraordinary way as a picture consciousness directly from your spiritual symbolic mind. And at other times, he'll talk about dreams in such a dismissive fashion, you would think, oh, I shouldn't study dreams, you know, which is absurd. But the thing is, he's talking about a particular, there's different types of dreams. They taught this in a theosophy in Ledbetter's work. I found this very interesting. He talked about the three types of dreams, and it seemed very consistent to me. One of the dreams was just about the physical environment. You know, was it hot that day? What did you eat? And all the rest of it. But the other thing that takes place is the psychological cataloging of you and your interactions throughout your day and your life. And that's a secondary stream of dreams. But then the third one is the most important, and the most kind of, you know, this is where you have dreams that come outside of time. So they're outside the realm of time and space. And in that direct channel of spiritual understanding, you have the ability to take in anything. And so they say in that state, you know, that the supernatural realm still speaks to humanity, and, you know, God still speaks to you in that state. But you also get visions and flashes of the future, maybe warnings for other people, things of this nature. What is that? How do you have the ability to predict that somebody's going to call you the next day that you haven't seen in 5 years? It is those dreams that stand outside of that realm. So that's the third category. And so I believe when Steiner's talking about one category, he's effusive in how important it is. And then he's talking about this other category, and he's sort of saying, oh, you know, it's a gibberish kind of picture consciousness that doesn't do anything for you. So, you know, obviously dreams are crucial and important. So I think when it comes to magnetic work, Steiner's very aware. But there's also, I think anyone who's around mystery schools, they're all aware of how things can be misused. And so everything kind of comes with a warning of go into it with the right intention. Because if you go into it as a left path self-aggrandizer, it's going to maybe cause more problems. Maybe it's better to just not even bother with it unless you're at that level where you can really take it on. I remember there's a wonderful segment in the New Testament where Jesus is talking about taking on the spiritual path. And he says, you know, it's better actually to be the person who does not take on the full path than the person who takes on the full path and quits in the middle. You'll actually end up in a worse situation. So you have
Once
to
started,
be,
you got to finish.
Exactly. Exactly. You have to be, you know, perfect on that track. And So I think there is something vital in that. Yes.
Nanette Christ, DJ, have you read the Casey readings where he warns against hypnosis and psychism generally without first seeking the kingdom of God through Christ?
Oh, I think all of them do in some sense. But there's, at the same time, you have to understand that somebody like Casey as a Sunday school teacher and a psychic, you know, they regard him as the outside occultist when he goes to these churches. So he, you know.
Well, the power would be very corrupting.
Well, no, it would be just the opposite.
No. I mean, if you didn't. That, you know, if
developed, yeah, of course,
the power of, I mean, just even if went in with good intentions, you know, if people get easily corrupted, right?
Oh, of course.
How else can I use this? Obviously for lottery numbers, et cetera.
Oh, yeah. There's all kinds of ways. Absolutely. No, I took the question a little bit differently, which is that, you know, you're right. You're making a good point, which is if, you know, somebody just wakes up and they're telepathic and psychic, they can do all kinds of terrible things with that, and it can actually mutate their future dramatically.
Bad karma.
However, these are your birthright. Also, you have the ability to tap into your true self, your true development, your true unconscious. So it's not something to be feared of, you know, and it's not something to see. I think for years what happened was the church, because they didn't like the power differential that was going on, they were like, oh, you know, people discover their own psychic power, they don't need us, you know, and so punish them, you know, you're a witch for having psychic ability. And they did. They punished them, witches, you know, they called them witches, and they punished these people for just having the most, you know, incredible powers and abilities. What would they have done with Emma Britton in the Middle Ages? You know, they probably would have burned her at the stake. So that kind of superstition from the religious traditions, I think, is anathema. That's the way that culture got crippled in the first place. You know, we have to take the heathen and get rid of all their books and all their, you know, this is a tricky thing. The ethics work on all sides, you know. It's the person who's pointing out the thing has to be ethical, and the person who's doing the thing has to be ethical. So ethics is absolutely core. You cannot cultivate real psychic abilities. This is an interesting thing, because Pesaguer said the first rule was to, he got from mesmerism that it was all about love, in fact. And he was like, you know, the first rule was to have the highest desire for a good outcome from the person you were treating. This was the important thing. You could never have any negative emotions when you're doing magnetism. No. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. Great questions tonight. The ideas from Mesmer, Mozart, Secret Magnetism, Trance Mystery Revealed. There's more to reveal on this, and we are going to do another episode, but wow, you know, it goes very deep. And when you get into the meaning of the trance and what is available to someone, remember Casey saying you could write a concerto, or you could, you know, give instructions for fishing. I mean, it's a universal library of information, the ability to tap into that. Now, Steiner is going even to another step. He's saying, you know, there's a great mystery in hypnosis about the interplay between the hypnotist and the subject. And it taps into the mystery of people and their relationship to each other. This is the key aspect. And what he is saying is they reduced hypnosis down to some few techniques because they wanted science to control it. But when you reduce it down, it doesn't even have the framework for what it actually is, which is an exchange, as Mesmer was saying, of magnetic energies. This is what's actually taking place. And I remember seeing a program that was from Russia. And
I remember this.
I got a recording of it. And it was a very popular show in morning television in Russia from 2002. And it was an older guy, and he would sit down exactly like I'm sitting right here. And he would look into the camera and they would play very light little kind of, you know, waterfall sound. And it was morning healing. And he would sit there and he would activate this healing vibe directly through the camera. And people would tune in and just, you know, feel like this guy's giving me a magnetic healing. Well, this gets into a question, doesn't it? Which is, that kind of healing travels through all kinds of things. And it makes you wonder about the nature of magnetic healing. Yes.
What was so cool about that is that, I mean, that was mainstream Russian TV, you know?
And that was their morning show. Yeah.
Exactly. Like instead of the Today Show, or say, can you imagine like some master magnetic healer?
Psychically, they're very, very advanced.
Like sending you sort of intense blessings for the day. Oh my God, what a way to start the day. On another note, okay, so I do want to make sure I said this.
Yes.
Is that Wesley Sullivan said Mike Tyson was also hypnotized frequently by his first trainer, Cus D'Amato. That's amazing. Mm-hmm.
Well, I remember John Lennon was very into studying visualization, and he gives all kinds of different stories of things that he was following. But one was about a basketball team that was training versus the other team, which wasn't training, but were visualizing. They'd still do some training, but they would, you know, take the rest of the time and visualize winning. And then that team would always win. So obviously visualization has a great deal to do with these things. The force of a crowd, you know, everyone knows when you play home games, you know, why is it that people win more when they're in their home ball field? Is it because they know it better? No, it's because the audience is on your side. I wanted to throw a couple of pictures up here and then we'll take your last two questions. How does that grab you?
Sounds good.
Okay, fantastic. Everyone, this is X-Series 171, The Dark Journalist Show, Mesmer Mozart, Secret Magnetism, Trance Mystery Revealed. And the magnetism, there's a lot of this that's emerging here, right in this very conversation and here with us in the ideas room, which is uncorking a deeper conversation. This could go into interesting places. Of course, that's a shot of Casey and in the New York Times in 1910 when people didn't understand, what is he doing? How does he do it? How does it work? And the hypnosis thing, which had been a fad, as it were, now they were starting to understand, okay, this guy in trance is giving health readings and people are getting better. So they didn't know really how to deal with them. But something very specific about Edgar's powers allowed him to use this method better than almost anyone. Emma Britton, I didn't really say much about Emma Britton tonight, but I want to include her, of course, as a co-founder of the Theosophical Society. I've done episodes on Emma Britton. She is so important, but one of the most wonderful things that I have of hers is her autobiography. And in that autobiography, she talks about the Orphic Circle and how they trained her because they had learned that her grandfather was this incredible mystic from Wales named Floyd, last name Floyd, first name Pink, maybe. And somehow she was selected based on this. And so under the guise of giving her a classical music education, they were actually using her as a somnambulist and getting all this information. And she was saying, now, I guess, you know, some people have died and I can say, like, you know, Benjamin Disraeli, who was the prime minister of Britain, and Charles Dickens and others were, you know, among the people who were observing me doing this. And there's some amazing stories of her giving these trance readings as, you know, between the ages of 10 and 15. And then from there, this Orphic Circle, you know, moved her into a career of acting and on the stage and all the rest of it. And when she goes to New York, she's involved in a stage thing. She's left behind the psychic experience, but then she's surrounded by all the spiritualism. She lands in New York and there are all these spiritualist circles and table rappers and everything else. So it starts to reawaken her own incredible psychic abilities. And she sees these two girls walking around and she recognizes them as sort of fellow psychics. And they have something almost like a sandwich board they're walking around with, and it says psychic reading, you know. And there they are, the Fox sisters. The Fox sisters, according to Steiner, were part of the plan for the mystery schools to bring spiritualism out of the closet. And in fact, that's exactly what they do. What happens is the support of the mystery schools withdraws dramatically from spiritualism because people are, you know, taking it in a different direction than they had assumed. And they, when they do that retreating, the characters themselves seem to fall apart in public a little bit. So I wonder about the relationship between the schools and the individuals that they select. One of those people, of course, who is selected as a compromise figure in all of this, the compromise between the mystery schools that did want to release things and did not want to release things, was Madame Blavatsky and Theosophy. And we all know the incredible things that she was able to bring forward. Finally, this last picture that I discovered, and it is Orson Welles playing Cagliostro in the movie Cagliostro, 1949. And that is definitely a Mason symbol, along with all of these other really fascinating astrological symbols. And, you know, I want to thank my mother for this, because my mother was such a student of movies and books, and she understood my interests. And whenever something would come up that she knew I'd be interested in, you know, on the wacky front, she would send it over to me. She for years would tell me about this movie. She said, "You have to see this movie. It's everything you're interested in." It. She's like, "Cagliostro's in it, Mesmer's in it, like everybody's in it." So that's one definitely to check out. And with that, Miss Olivia, your last two questions.
Okay, let's end on a positive note.
Sure. The whole thing was positive.
Well, I could go dark. Joseph Tuga says, does hypnosis harness the scalar potential of the brain, like when people go into a trance to walk on fire? And Julie Villanueva says, I've heard accounts of people who have seen libraries in heaven that have books of inventions waiting to give to people here on earth. I am wondering, with that comment, can we utilize hypnosis to access those libraries, to read those books and utilize them for the benefit of humanity, to create innovations? And do you think that's being done?
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely. And it reminds me of a story. There's a very fascinating... What's great about Casey's life story is there's so many fascinating anecdotes from it. And for me, this one is particularly interesting. So he meets Morton Blumenthal, who's this big stockbroker in New York. And he, you know, the guy is fascinated with Casey. He's like, oh my God, there's so many things that you could do. But this guy is no just, you know, flim flam Wall Street guy. He's very interested in all these mystical traditions. He has his own study course around Uspensky in the fourth way. He does all these different things. He's into Blavatsky and all the rest. So he's a very spiritual seeker. And what happens is he starts to get these readings from Casey, and his father has recently passed away. And he's getting this information from Casey about different stocks and things. And he says, who's giving me the information? And Casey says, it's your father, Randolph. And Morton says, you know, tell me more. What's going on over there? You know, what else, what other messages does he have for me? And so basically Casey indicates to him that on the other side, Randolph, Morton's father, has put together a network of these other investors who were alive during his time. And they're working on the other side to help Morton and his brother Edwin become great stock moguls. So we don't really know what's going on in a lot of ways. There are a number of things that happen. I remember when Casey was asked, you know, what's going on with this guy that he's having all these fits and he's like, you know, freaking out on his wife and stuff. And Casey says it's possession. And they said, what do you mean possession? And he says, possession under the control of other entities while under the influence of alcohol. And they said, well, what are the other entities? And he said, discarnates. So people that have not moved beyond this realm but are still operating. And he says, well, you know, how do you, what can you do? And Casey gives them a number of things. And they say, well, how do these discarnates show up? You know, like, how did this happen? And he said, well, he left himself open to the influences because the alcohol opened up his system. It basically opened up his kundalini to these negative entities. But then he starts to talk about discarnates and he says, they say, well, who are they? And he says, well, they're individuals that have moved beyond this realm but are still in the earth plane generally. And he says, there are thousands about us here at present, thousands about us. So while he's giving the psychic reading, there's thousands of discarnates. And he says, seeking expression. Ooh. Some good expression, some not good expression, right? It's like daily life, but it's interesting to know the field that we're in, if you think about it. Isn't that incredible? Wow.
You know, there's a question that came up.
Yeah.
Donna Marie Farrell says, discarnates, can we help them?
Oh, yes.
Well, I mean, it's you better be careful engaging with them at all.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if it's a relative or something, absolutely. You know, yeah, I mean, I think all the same rules apply, you know, which is generally positive outgoing attitude and also a protective attitude, just like in a haunted house or in a location where something bad has taken place, for example. And I read about a lot of them. I wanted to put this on the record before we end this episode. It's very unusual. What a beautiful book by Henry Alcott, the co-founder of the Theosophical Society. It's a series of books, but I can't recommend enough, called Old Diary Leaves, which are all his experiences meeting Blavatsky and the things that happened in their life. And they're loaded with incredible anecdotes. But he says something interesting talking about mesmerism. And he said that just like I mentioned the term mystical Masonic earlier, here he uses the term, which I thought was interesting, mutual mesmerism. I think we have a hint here that there were different versions of these things. And something he said caught my attention. Let's see if I have it here. Aha. The first prerequisite of a magician or adept is a prophetic or naturally mediumistic organization. That and the sitting of circles, mutual mesmerism, the cultivation of intercourse with spirits of those who have passed beyond, and the acceptance of spirit guides and controls, and substantial lawful aids to the development of adept powers. Whatever adept may have written this book must assuredly become the process of editing and translating it. And he was talking about the adepts that were working with Blavatsky. What's interesting is he talks about a condition, and I wish I had the term for the condition, but he mentions a condition that women have in his era where they have swollen glands, and how he found it fascinating that the women that he met in the Theosophical Society who had this, who were prone to swollen glands, tended to be exceptional psychics. And he said he got the impression when he was pestering Blavatsky about this that it was kind of the price that they had to pay for operating with this higher frequency, that it messed with their body chemistry a little bit. That is a real, I don't even know what to say about that, but I think we get a hint of a lot of things that we take for granted in physical everyday life, that there's some deeper psychic significance to the thing, even if it seems, you know, the term swollen glands, for example, you know, you just think of some annoying thing. And yet here he is relating it directly as a kind of an after effect of having this ability to be psychic. What do you make of that?
I'm thinking about it with me. I'm thinking about just kind of a when you're sensitive and you're open and you are responding to energies of this world and other worlds, that's it's a whole other layer of mediation you've got to do and balancing.
That's really true.
A really grounded, earthy guy doesn't have to do it all, right? It's a burden.
Wow. Yeah. We'll have to have Gigi Young list a number of those for us. Thank you, everyone. That is the end of the show for tonight. Oh. And Miss Olivia, you're up with your super chat people.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I'm a little behind.
That's fine.
Okay. While I'm getting the drawing.
No worries at all.
You did not mention any of this, and this was the dark stuff. Thomas Ball was asking, Charles Manson proved to the CIA you could hypnotize people to kill. And Wally Tango Foxtrot said it works and it is weaponized. There's a whole, could you just talk for a minute to balance things out about the dark side of hypnotism and what we know about it and who has developed it?
Well, I think that, because the mesmerism really is coming from, it's coming from this higher place. You can turn any ability, including, psychokinetic abilities for negative purposes, but mesmerism for sure was coming from a positive place. And what's interesting is you are getting there into charisma, and it's funny because a lot of people think of charisma as a sinister thing. It's not. It's a ability or gift from God. And that's what, you know, there's a lot of celebrities and people who, you know, beyond their talent, people just want to, there's something that magnetizes you into, and we've had a number of celebrities like this, you know, legends for years, right? And so we get a hint of it there. And then sometimes you meet people in life who are just incredibly charismatic. That's just part of a function of who they are. And it's more of like wearing the magnetism that they have on their sleeve. You know, it's part of who they are. Marilyn Monroe had incredible, beyond her looks, had incredible magnetism to her. And, you know, great leaders like JFK and all the rest of it. I mean, Hitler had a lot of charisma.
But,
there's,
you know,
no question
about
it.
I've thought about this a lot. All of these people that have great magnetism have great willpower. They like desire mind. You know, Marilyn, they all wanted attention. Maybe, you know, for different purposes, but there's something about charisma and will and willpower that
I think we'll tackle it in a fuller sense in another show. But I tend to think of charisma as an incredibly positive characteristic. The thing is, when you have it, when you have that ability to influence people and you have a very strong will and people pay attention to it, you can use it for good or bad purposes. And so the challenge is how to use it for good purposes. And I will leave you with a sketch, an original sketch of Mesmer giving directions of one of his mesmerizing exercises. Wow. To be in Mesmer's head, huh? Very interesting indeed. Animal magnetism, as it were. And Miss Olivia, you're up.
All right. So, Song of Prayer, Thomas Ball, Short Order Cook 1, Allerminine Bay, McHatton, Les Scott, The Bikini Truther, David John Moen, Norman Smith, Jay Parsons, Terry Doherty, Melody Lenz, Erica Swenson Elliott, Doyle Wayne, Yrthmiz Fun, C.A. Beverforden, Thomas Ball, Channeling the Heart, Barbara Joyce, Jenny Runco, Descat Brock, Roosevelt Media News, Debbie McAdoo. I think that's it. And I wanted to mention, really important, Barbara Joyce has had a heart attack, and she is not in good shape, and she is asking for prayers. And I know we have some powerful people in the ideas room.
I hope she's doing better. My God, the challenge on that. Take it very easy and surround yourself with the things that you enjoy the most. I would definitely say about that. Incredible. Wow, just fantastic being here. I'm going to do some shout outs for everyone here. And you can feel the mesmerization of the entire audience there tonight. There's a wonderful shot of a mesmeric environment. And of course, a little mesmeric lightning coming down. I love some of these drawings because, of course, he's shooting in, you know, good, healthy energy, but it looks a little sinister. And that is one of the pools, the famous magnetizing pools that Mesmer set up in France in the 1780s. And one of the things I want to give Mesmer a lot of credit for, when the medical community started to kind of be like, hey, you know, this is out of control or whatever, he was like, you know, come on, baby, you know, come on, King, bring it on. I'll take a medical commission. You're four top guys. I'll show them the whole thing, how it works. Bring them down. You got it. I'm here for you. So he was not a shrinking violet, and he was very confident in his method and technique. And I think it shows you a lot about he knew where he was coming from on it. And I do think that Puysegur was able to take it to an even deeper place, but he always gave the credit back to Mesmer. He never was like, oh, I'm discovering something new. He said, oh, you know, it was all because Mesmer made the original discovery, but he took it with that telepathic hypnosis to a deeper place. That's where we can really go on the mystery side with this. So we have Brenda Fisher out there wishing Barbara a better time. And who else we got? Quirky Goss. Good, clean fun. I agree with you. Mesmerizing. Indeed. Indeed. Delta Echo. Erica Swanson Elliott, it's great to see you out there. Thank you for being with us tonight in the Ideas Room. Thomas Ball senses love. Debbie McAdoo says, Barbara Joyce will be praying for you. Lenny Bogart is having a good time out there. Wesley Sullivan, thanks, DJ and Olivia. Fantastic show. Scarlet Fire. Buddha of Boston Sports. Liddy Lou. Darla Cash. Outstanding. Thomas Ball. Just a great crew out there in the Ideas Room. Another awesome show. We will be back with you next week. Oh, someone says, this is interesting. Someone says, Dark Journalist, Hitler kept himself from sexual release, Vril. He specifically talked about how it gave him his power of speaking. There's a whole thing with Buddhist monks and Masonic lodges, and there's all kinds of interesting things around that. So very interesting. The usual suspects, says Thomas Ball. Indeed. Universal Logic, love from London. Lenny, thank you so much. We love London, and we love you being here. Wesley Sullivan, Bikini Truther. Bikini Truther. DJ, why didn't you go to Contact in the Desert? I have a very funny history of Contact in the Desert, but basically, no. You know, it's also, from what I hear, not, you know,
what it once was.
Yeah, but I guess it never really was. But anyway, for anyone who's there and having a good time, that's good. I guess I always felt that, you know, from the days when they kind of let in the real fluffy stuff, that it wasn't for me. But they probably wouldn't want me there anywhere. I'd scare the hell out of them. Let's get real. But if you're there, I hope you're having a good time, Bikini Truther. Rocket for all of us. And it's a good location. I know that from that incredible Integratron is not far from there, as we know.
I would love to go there.
And we know that he was into some very, very interesting
talk
things.
About developing magnetism there. That would be incredible.
Do you think they have lots of CIA there? Oh, I think Jim Semivan used to go there regularly, and he picked up a lot of stuff. They do. They have a presence at UFO conferences. They make them a target because there's some of them who even talk openly about that. What I found disturbing was that Jim Semivan was in the audience at ARE He talked about it, actually. So, you know, I don't know. I feel, you know, I feel like people like that who try to push the UFO threat thing, you know, it's hard when they start saying, oh, I'm a contactee or whatever. CIA 25 years. I don't know. Oh boy, DJ, Night's Light, indeed. Donna Marie Farrell. Have there been good people who've worked in the CIA? Yes. And I know what happens to them is they get out. it's inevitable, you know, because the organization's corrupt and the people, you know, you can have good analysts, you can have the smartest people who get recruited into different things. But unfortunately, the organization is bad. Golden Girl, great to see you out there. Charlotte Knight. Mozart, indeed. Dumbledore had a pool. That's a good point. Real good point. Harmony Woods, nicely done. Nina says, blessings to you in the ideas room, dark journalist. Olivia Wingsgirl, such a wonderful crowd. Congratulations, Olivia Wingsgirl. Nicely done. We will be back with you next week. And it's great to have so many of you here. I'll do one last shout out because I'm in that kind of mood. Let's see, Gypsy Moon. Fantastic. Jimmy Lyle Kennemore. Golden Girl, Plan D. Whew, just the whole crowd is out there.
So if anybody wanted to do any follow-up research.
Oh, come to the next X-Series show. No. In Search of the Miraculous, of course, is fantastic. I like an old there's a book on mesmerism by Robert Darnton, and you think the guy, because he has the kind of Yale background, is going to do a flat job on it. It's so funny to me because a lot of these people have to do the job. When did you retire, DJ? LOL. I never got to retire. I probably never will be able to. What I was going to say is that a lot of people feel that they owe it to their academic background to never actually look into the thing from a point of view that it could be real, but just to say, oh, here's how people responded to it because they were in the frenzy of the French Revolution. And there's a lot of that in this book, but nonetheless, there's interesting facts in that book. I have an incredible, there's a book on Eurythmy, which is this very interesting little book by Thomas Poplawski, Rhythm, Dance, and Soul. Very interesting book on Steiner's instructions around it. Eurythmy, of course, Old Diary Leaves, and Emma Britton's autobiography. There's a lot of somnambulism in her biography for sure. So yeah, lots and lots of good things there. And I would say that there are some, you know, proper biographies of Mesmer out there, but I still think that it's more from the mystery traditions themselves, little hints from people like Blavatsky, little hints from people like Steiner and, you know, Beelzebub's tales and things like that. Give me quite a feeling about Mesmer's work and how they're aware, and they can't say how, but they're aware that that came directly out of that mystery school tradition and probably from a very high Rosicrucian order would be my impression. It's just released out to the public as a gift, as it were. Spread the love, Nitwit. I like that one, but it's Nit, K-N-I-T. Viking. Has DJ ever done an episode on H.G. Wells? He's been included in an episode, but you know, that's a fantastic idea because of the outrageous, how far ahead can somebody be in society of what's going to happen? So great suggestion. Fantastic. All right. CC, I'm going to go get hypnotized. Well, make sure you get the right one. That's important too. The Manitou Eatery. That's a great name. What we consider is real is a metaphor of that which is mesmerizing. We can't get better than that than a closing quote for tonight. Thank you all so much. We will see you all next week. We have a fantastic show coming up for you. Great interviews. And of course, our documentary is out, Hacking Atlantis, The Craze in the Hot Zone. Really exciting ideas. deep in there. And we put a lot of production into that as well. More documentary series coming for you. And, you know, it says end broadcast, but after all,
never really ends.
It never really ends. And, you know, never let it be forgot. Once there was a Camelot, and we just had John Kennedy's birthday yesterday. Happy birthday, Mr. President. And just incredible the impact John Kennedy had. And here we are 60 years later, and the echo from the incredible things that he did is still with us, and the type of America that he worked for, we can still have if we get rid of the barbarians who performed the incredible Manhattan miscarriage of justice. But that'll be overturned for sure. And we can return the country back into some sensible hands November 5th. That's the challenge here. We're going to work very hard to do that. So thank you all. And let's keep Mesmer and Peseguer and Emma Britton and those that have built this understanding for us in mind, and maybe we can build on their work with our own mesmerism. Have a great night, everyone.
God bless.